Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Are you ready? It's time for DLC, and wherever you are, whenever you are, and however you happen to be listening, we're so glad you've chosen to tune in, especially if you are one of our geeks in sneaks using this show to power you through a workout or a run, or hey, maybe you're doing housework, some chores. We're going to be in your ear holes for 90 plus minutes. We got your back because DLC is your downloadable commentary for the week delivered the way we love it to be, and that is completely free thanks to our sponsors this week. Casper and Fireside. They made that possible, bringing the show to you. DLC, of course, the show all about games in their many forms, games played on desktops, laptops, and consoles, and also games that involve dice, luck, and cardboard. I'm your host, Jeff Cannata, that's spelled with two N's and one T, and I am joined, as always, by my friend slash co-host slash nemesis, the guy who is always springing forward, even when he's falling back, Mr. Christian Spicer. Hello, Christian.
Hello, Jeff. Hello, everybody. New marriages sketches are available now.
I'm in that.
You are in that. You were in the first four. We shot three more, and you can find them all on my YouTube, which is just Christian Spicer 713. There's a playlist for all seven. The three new ones, I think, came out fantastic.
Yeah, they're really good. I'm very proud to be a part of that. Christian wrote some really, really funny stuff. So you guys should definitely take a few minutes and check those out.
Yeah, they're all like, I think the longest one's a minute 40. They're not, they don't overstay their welcome.
That's right. No, they're great. Speaking of things that don't overstay their welcome, the big announcement that I couldn't talk about last week, I can finally talk about. I'm doing a new daily show that also doesn't overstay its welcome. It's bite size. Newest, latest, best is back, Christian. It's back.
What?
Yeah. And it's going to be on Anchor, or not going to be. It is. It's there. You can listen to it. All week long, I've been doing new daily content on Anchor. You can find that. It's not easy to tell you the URL, but if you go to my Twitter feed, Jeff Cannata on Twitter, you can find a link to that. And I'm kind of tweeting out links every single day. There's new content, but it only lasts 24 hours. So you can't listen to yesterday's. You can only listen to today's and you got to check in every day. Really cool. It's going to be interactive. And it's also where Tabletop Time is going to live for the most part. When we have guests on the show that are into board games, we'll do Tabletop Time here. But because, you know, Christian's not so into it and it's been, you know, up and down on the show, it kind of tends to be a monologue. I'm going to leave it on the show where I do monologues. So if you're into Tabletop Time, that's where you can find it most often. In fact, today's episode, if you're listening today on Monday, today's episode is all board game talk. So check that out. All right. Moving on. We have a big show here today on DLC. Lots of cool news. And, you know, this is probably the best first 3 months in video games of all time. So lots of cool stuff to talk about. And we have an awesome guest to do it with. You know, the DLC always stands for your downloadable Cannata and your downloadable Christian. But this week we're excited because DLC stands for Drafting Literature and Columns, because we have a guest who is both a video game writer at Forbes and the author of the Earthborn trilogy. We are pleased to welcome Mr. Paul Tassie to the show. Hey, Paul.
Hey guys. Thanks for having me.
So Paul has an awesome microphone, and we were trying to make that microphone work. For some reason, we couldn't get it to cooperate with the software that we use to record the show. So he is unfortunately having to use a less good microphone. So please bear with us this episode. He'll maybe sound a little hollow, but we think it's worth having him on because he's an awesome guy. So you know, save your emails and your tweets. We know that it doesn't sound as good as it could have, but
Paul sounds hollow. Kevin Bacon was in Hollow Man. Zelda is about Link, who is a man who stars in Breath of the Wild. This is a video game podcast. 9/11 was an inside job. I think I did it.
Good job. Good job. All right. Let's get to the rest of the show and start the way we always do with Story of the Week.
Story of the Week. It's the Story of the Week. Story of the Week. It's the Story of the Week.
Story of the Week is the part of the show where we make our case for the most important stories that happened in the world of games this week. And you can always submit your stories by using our hashtag on Twitter, that is DLCSOTW, or by visiting our subreddit, which is 5x5dlc.reddit.com. Lots of cool stories submitted this week. Lots of cool discussion happening. You can also always submit emails to us by using the email address dlcfeedback@gmail.com. Paul, you are our guest, so you get first pick of stories. What would you consider to be the story of the week?
Story of the week. Let's see. What I've been following kind of hilariously over the course of the past 24 hours was the YouTuber critic Jim Sterling gave Zelda 7 out of 10, and Nintendo fans have been losing their mind for.
Yes. How dare he? He deserves to be doxxed and he deserves his site to be shut down. A 7 out of 10. That's unacceptable. He deserves to be silenced. No one should ever listen or read anything he says, right? That's the opinion of the gist of it.
Yeah, and everyone's so mad because he took the Metacritic score down from the 98, which was tied for one of the best of all time, to just a mere 97. So now it's tied with a bunch of other, you know, riffraff, like some 97 of the other greatest games of all time.
Right. 97 is garbage. It should never be played by anyone. A 98 is or above is the only games that I will ever play. Let's DDoS Jim Sterling and let's slander him and do everything we can, because how dare you? Actually, I would love to read Jim Sterling's entire review. Unfortunately, I can't, because his site has been DDoSed. I tried to read it this morning. I was able to read the sort of snippet that Metacritic pulled out, which basically he said that while it is an amazing game, it's hidden behind some frustrating mechanics. I mean, we'll probably be talking lots of Zelda in the playlist segment, but what is your feeling about this whole story? I mean, obviously, as reviewers, we want somebody to be able to say their opinion, but what is your feeling on where he stands and what he said about the game and the reaction to it?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, it kind of comes down to a lot of the stuff he lists as the game's faults are faults that I can also acknowledge are in the game, but there are things I was willing to overlook kind of as time went on. Like, he really cites, you know, weapon durability in Zelda as being like this huge annoyance, and stuff like not being able to climb in the rain and things that are kind of annoying, but over time I've kind of gotten to appreciate them. And like, I think the weapon breakability kind of encourages diversity of play and like different styles, but it just seems like he ultimately wasn't able to kind of get past a lot of that stuff. And then he generally thinks that kind of the format of the game with all these like kind of what he calls Ubisoft towers and the shrines as these individual puzzle locations scattered, it just doesn't feel like it's really fits in with the Zelda narrative. And I don't know. I mean, I kind of disagree with that, and I think it's kind of well integrated into the game in a way that doesn't feel forced. But I don't know. I mean, I fully disagree with his review, but I understand and respect his right to write it and to score it however he wants.
Yeah. My old colleague on the Totally Rad show, Dan Trachtenberg, coined a term that we used a lot when we were doing that show. He would call that stuff the good suck. It sucks, but it's a good suck. When your weapon breaks, nobody wants their weapon to break. Nobody wants to not be able to climb a mountain in the rain. All those things suck, but it's a good suck because it forces you to play the game in a different way. It is the speed bump that makes you appreciate when you can, you know, drive fast. It's the frame on the picture that forces the picture to be contained in an interesting way. And I completely agree with that. I mean, I think those things are annoying, and there are moments where I'm like, oh, I just want the rain to stop. But that is part of that simulation of that universe. But I guess the more pertinent part of this topic, Christian, is why are we such jerks in the gaming community? Why do people feel the need to react this way when someone has a different opinion than they do?
Well, unfortunately, I don't think it's limited to the gaming community. And to answer the bigger question, I'm not sure why. I think part of it is fandom. People want the thing that they think is the best to be universally regarded as the best. So I think people take offense to, someone viewing something differently than they do, or that combined with the idea that they're maybe doing it to get clicks, to get page views.
To be contrarian, right? To be the,
right. Yeah. They don't trust the integrity of the art of the review. It's, you know, you're either paid if it's too high, like Marvel pays you everything. Every Marvel cinematic movie pays you, Jeff, but every Fox Marvel movie doesn't.
If only.
And DC doesn't. No, I didn't say they pay you a lot. You're just easy to buy off. It's like a quarter.
That's a sandwich, is what right.
And then if you break the other way, it's, well, of course you're going for page views or your clicks or you just wanted to stand out or, you know, whatever it is. But it happens, and I kind of understand it. I remember it felt like a little bit of a kick to the crotch when, I forget the reviewer, the first person who gave the film Get Out a rotten review, dropping that from 100 to 98 or 99. Ultimately, it doesn't matter, but it was kind of cool when this film that I think is important and amazing and by a creator that I think is amazing, you know, it's fun to see it ride that wave of quote unquote perceived perfection.
Talking about Armin White, probably.
It was Armin White.
Yeah.
Was it?
Okay. Yeah. He's sort of a notable contrarian as well in the movie review space. Yeah.
So like when that happened, I was kind of like, dang it. But ultimately, it doesn't matter. But it happens in other spaces as well. You know, there's a whole network of people complaining about sports trades, right? Like, I mean, there are several cable TV shows, podcasts, radio shows where there are literal Monday morning quarterbacks. And, you know, like, yeah. It's not exclusive to games.
You're absolutely right, of course. But to keep it in the game space, maybe the best way to frame this question is, does Metacritic do a disservice to gamers? Is the focus on this weird abstraction of an amalgamation of reviews worth caring about? What do you think, Paul?
I think generally speaking, Metacritic does a decent job of kind of conveying the overall health of a game. It's a little different than Rotten Tomatoes, where the scores you see there are kind of a lot more varied. But at this point in the gaming space, we've kind of understood that if a game is a 70, that's, you know, not that great. That's kind of like a C-. Like, we almost kind of have adopted this letter grade system now, where most everything is between a 7 and a 10, and under that is failing. So like if it's a 6, it's a D+. It's not a 6 out of 10 for a movie review, which would technically be positive. Overall, I think it becomes a problem when we get these like super intense fanboy wars over like one point in a score, or when developers or publishers start setting up bonuses if a developer hits a certain Metacritic score. Like, that is super unhealthy. But again, I don't think that's the critic's fault or Metacritic's fault. That is on the publishers for putting that in place, and it's on the fans for kind of overreacting. Like, I'm not a huge fan of scores, but I don't think they're this pervasive problem that they need to be kind of banished. I think the issues are kind of outside that.
My take on this is, I've always been a harsh critic of Metacritic. I visited the site maybe once or twice. Maybe the second time ever was when today I looked at Jim Sterling's thing, because I couldn't find it any other place. I do not like Rotten Tomatoes. I do not like Metacritic. I do not use them. And I think for me, the reason that I don't is that they don't engender conversation. They don't – the idea of a critic pointing out flaws in Zelda, I think, is interesting, because maybe it can create a conversation that other people aren't having. That is the point of criticism. The point of criticism or just review in general is – not to arrive at consensus. And I think that Metacritic aims to create a false sense of consensus. We took all the reviews together and everybody agreed it's an 80. No. Some guy said it's a 90 and some guy said it's a 70 and now you have an 80. That's not consensus. That's average and it's useless
you have,
to me.
You have 1,000 of those. I mean, I don't mean
to
this.
To a place where groupthink has kind of come to a consensus, but I don't find that useful.
Well, you go to a lot of movies for free and you receive a third, I don't know, of games for free. And I do think that colors your opinion on these things. Like when I'm viewing, and I think, you know, regular person with limited free time and whose job isn't to go see movies and play games, like you and I can both tell our wives, hey, babe, sorry, I know it's Friday. I need to play Zelda for 4 hours or five. You know what I mean? Like, and they'll understand. Other people that have normal lives and budgets that they need to consider, and then maybe there's a game they don't know about, and are they going to buy? I mean, how many emails or tweets did we get? Hey, should I get a VR headset or a Switch for Zelda? I don't have a Wii U. And that's a very real consideration. And so those people want our opinions, but I don't think it's annoying for them to also seek out a broad consensus to see what the quote unquote Yelp score is for something. And then you can tweak that as you need. I don't think people rely wholly on that. I think I would kind of roll my eyes at someone that says like, oh, if a game is 69 or below, I definitely will not play it no matter what. But to use it as like a jumping off point for should I dive deeper into this thing or is this thing worth my time? I mean, that makes sense to me. Unless I see Paul's name on a review, then I just disregard it entirely. I'm like, idiot.
Well, that's the other part of this is like you talk about, you know, Metacritic trying to create this kind of consensus. But, well, it is this one big number that appears, you know, on the homepage. The whole point of those is being a review aggregator. So you have this list of 60 reviews, so you can see why people gave a game a 10 out of 10 or why someone gave it a 7 out of 10. You have the option of reading all those individual reviews, either based on if it's an outlet you like or a critic you like, or it kind of creates the situation where you can be involved as you want to be in your own pursuit of information. And like I personally have found it useful because, you know, say I've gotten tomatoes. If some movie I've really never heard of is scoring like 95 plus, I think that helps a movie like Get Out, like without, you know, people seeing how highly that was scoring. Like this is literally one of the best horror movies critics have seen in 10 years. I think that really helps it. And it goes above and beyond just kind of word of mouth. So I do kind of extract some use from those sites.
Yeah. I mean, I don't disagree that, having a place that aggregates all the reviews in one place is not useful. I think that is certainly – it's nice to be able to say, oh, I can click through all the reviews for one thing. That's great. But I do think the oversimplification of that to distill that down to a number, which is I think you would have to admit the most common use of Metacritic or the common reference to Metacritic is like, oh, here's that number that it's been all distilled down to. I just think that – that shorthand isn't particularly useful for me. And I don't necessarily think it's just because I'm playing everything. It's because I don't think I want you, Christian, to conflate the idea of not liking a forced consensus with not liking reviews or not taking advice from reviews. I certainly encourage, as somebody who gives my opinion for a living, I certainly encourage people to take advice from reviews, but I think it's much more useful to seek out and find those voices that you resonate with, or even if you don't resonate with them, you can find out some aspect of their character that makes you understand whether or not you will agree or disagree with them. So you watch enough Jim Sterling, you go, I'm definitely going to have a different feeling about Zelda than Jim Sterling is. Or, oh my gosh, I'm glad somebody's finally saying what he's saying because I often agree with Jim Sterling or Jeff Cannata or Christian Spicer or whomever. I think it is, instead of creating this weird objective consensus, it is get more subjective and find the subjects that you agree with or can actually understand where they're coming from.
I love that thought. Dilstead in the chat is saying, you know, people want an easy way to determine if something is worth their time. Aggregate sites play right into that. People don't want to read a review. They don't have the attention span. And while that might hurt my soul a little bit, I think I agree. I mean, people find someone to keep them warm at night and or potentially marry by swiping left or right on their phone. Like, society is changing. Yeah. We are old.
All right. Now you're depressing me.
Zelda's a 92. There, I said it. I all out.
All right, Christian, what's your story of the week?
Well, it's hot off the press. PlayStation Now has said that PlayStation 4 games are coming to the service. I said that backwards. PlayStation 4 games are coming to PlayStation Now. This was announced maybe an hour ago as of recording this. There's no, at least from what I know, no date, no window specified, but I feel like this has to be a reaction to the Xbox Games Library, whatever that.
They couldn't have come up with a more generic name for that thing, right? It's very forgettable, whatever the
Xbox Game Pass, I think it is.
Yeah, Game Pass, yeah. Pretty boring.
Yeah, thank you, Paul. I feel like it has to be a reaction to that, because that, you know, it's similar in the sense that it's a subscription service and access to Xbox 360 games, but they also had Xbox One games, notably Halo 5 and a couple of others. And then PlayStation Now has been the subscription service that was exclusively PlayStation 3 games. And they had announced before that they were going to discontinue access to PlayStation Now via your Vita and some other devices. And they're going to, I think, limit it to just PlayStation 4 and PC. And they said that that would help ensure, a quality of the system. And now today the news is they're going to add PlayStation 4 games to that system that is currently $20 a month, I believe. But it's exciting. You know, it's getting closer to that. For a consumer, what can be beneficial of games as a service platform, it still is, you know, you're streaming the game, so it will still have its problems, I think, if your bandwidth isn't up to snuff. But Paul, is this a thing that you think that interests you, this kind of Game Pass, game subscription kind of service, or are you own a game, put it on your disc or put it on your hard drive kind of person?
I mean, I guess for me and my job, I'm getting copies of these games kind of outright. So subscribing to a service isn't necessarily appealing to me, but for the overall kind of direction of the industry, I definitely think this is a good direction to pursue. And like Sony adding PS4 games is pretty logical. I mean, that felt like something they were going to do kind of inevitably at this point. This whole streaming thing, I think one of the core reasons the Xbox Game Pass was kind of appealing out of the gate was that if you want and you don't have the bandwidth or don't want to deal with, you know, lag, which is really important when you're playing a game instead of a movie, you can just download the games. And Sony still does not seem to be offering that. I think it's still double the price, essentially. It has a bigger library, certainly, but I think it's $20 a month compared to $10 a month. I think it's a good step forward, and I think that we are just marching inevitably towards the end of physical media for games. And this is kind of one step in that direction again.
Yeah, I agree with everything you said. I definitely feel like the big difference for me, the big turning point other than price, which is not insignificant, being double, you know, what Xbox is talking about, is not being able to download that game and play it locally. And I think that I'm still in that place where that's how I want to interact with my games. We may get technologically to the place where that's irrelevant and it's indistinguishable from, you know, streaming it on a remote server somewhere to playing it locally, but we're not there yet. And I like this approach from Xbox saying, hey, download it to your local system. You just download whatever you want and play it from your Xbox locally. And I would like PlayStation to have an option like that, especially at double the price. But it is pretty cool to make these games much more accessible. And we're moving toward that day and date of a big release, which is, I think, really where the watershed moment is going to be. Because once, you know, Horizon Zero Dawn on day of is, you can play it streaming or you can play it by buying it from a store. I think that's really where this will become a viable, you know, way to play everything. And I think that's the moment that everything changes.
Yeah, some version of that, maybe if it's even just like the Netflix version where you'll get Daredevil comes there first, but like the Hollywood movie is going to be 4 months later still or something like that. But it's interesting, and it's interesting to see how developers and publishers kind of react to it and who remains victorious in this struggle for our, I'm already paying for it, subscription fee that you just kind of forget about on your credit card until you have to enter a new credit card number when your old credit card expires. And you're like, oh, what is all that crap I'm subscribed to? What? Kitty litter delivery? My cat's been dead 10 years.
Oh, it's so sad. You guys have left me a lot of stories. There's a lot of juicy tidbits that have happened this week for Story of the Week. I think my favorite, the one that has certainly intrigued me the most, is a new update to No Man's Sky that dropped, I guess, late last week, very early this week. This story was submitted by Azrael Cans in the subreddit. This is the Pathfinder update for No Man's Sky, and it adds a lot of really cool stuff. Vehicles. I mean, we've already had obviously your spaceship, but now you've got land vehicles, not just one, but three different types of land vehicles that you can build and acquire. And it's got all kinds of PlayStation 4 Pro improvements like 4K rendering and HDR lighting and stuff. It's got new difficulty modes, a permadeath mode included. But for me, even more than the vehicles is this idea that you can now share your bases with other people and they can leave messages or you can leave messages for them. Now, finally, in this game, the way I have affected my planet or any planet I find can be visited by other players. I can have some reason for building all the structures that I can now build with the most, you know, the latest update or the most previous update. I feel like this is the way the game was supposed to be. This is the way the game should have been when it was released. So, Paul, my question to you is, do you think this is cool? Do you think it's too little too late? Or do you think maybe the game should have been released as a quote-unquote early access title while they were working on all this cool stuff?
I think in hindsight, early access probably would have been the right call given, you know, what it launched as and how they're kind of adding to it now. And I think a lot of people kind of feel burned after that. That said, I have been kind of one of the biggest No Man's Sky was actually pretty good people out there since launch. Mm. And I played, you know, all the updates. This one, I wrote a story about it. And I'm like, well, there's no ETA and when this is launching. And then it like immediately launched. I'm like, oh, crap. So I have not gotten to play around with it yet because I've been 80 hours deep into Zelda. Now I'm starting Mass Effect. So I have to get to that eventually. But what I find the coolest about it, I'm so-so on the vehicles. I think once you kind of get the three and then kind of roam around a little bit, that's probably the extent of it. And I wonder about the leaving messages for people because this is a game where there's trillions of planets. Like, so what are the odds of someone actually stumbling across your base unless they added some new system where you can like really, really seek out people, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering if you post messages if anyone will ever read them.
At least Twitter now or No Man's Sky? What are we talking about?
Yeah, pretty much. But the one aspect of the update I think is the coolest is the photo mode.
Oh, right.
They really put in a ton of photo tools, and I haven't played, but I've been browsing these galleries and galleries of these absolutely gorgeous screenshots. And that is even before this mode existed, just when you could like remove your heads up display. I love taking photos in this game. So adding this mode is probably the coolest feature for me.
Yeah, I guess you can like place the sun anywhere you want to really make the lighting look as cool as possible. And you're right, there have been some awesome photos that I've seen online already. Photo modes in games aren't really my jam. I just don't have the patience for it, I guess. But I like seeing what other people come up with photo modes.
It's so good in Horizon Zero Dawn. That had a great photo mode. Yeah. That's like a perfect game for it.
Totally. Christian, what do you think about this? You were a defender of No Man's Sky early on your home planet that you never left. So what do you think?
Yeah, unfortunately, my characters had permadeath since I quit playing it. I enjoyed the game. It's just, and it scratched a very particular itch for me. And I had been leaving messages for people on my planet since I started playing it. If anyone landed there, they'd be like, why does every rock here look like a penis? And I would say, welcome to my planet.
It's utopia for you.
It really is. Dick Rock Mountain, I think is what I named it. For me, though, I bounced other things either for this show or just because I'm a moth to a flame. And then when I've said on here before, when Forza Horizon 3 came out And I love Cars, and I've loved those games. And that scratch, that same itch that I was getting in No Man's Sky, I'm just kind of a chill, I'm playing, I don't really care what I'm doing, I just like being here kind of thing, moment to moment. And when that came out, I can't go back. I think it's great they're still working on it. Hopefully people love it, but it's like, this March is maybe the best month for video games ever, and they're all 80 hours, and I can't.
Yeah, so for you, it is too little, too late, right?
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah, it's sad. I kind of feel the same way. And I think if the game had hit with these features, it would have had a different, completely different place in my mind, which is a little bit of a...
Or as early access, I think then people, you plant that flag in it and you view it as a thing to check in on from time to time, versus like, here's this release. People are like, I want to... Well, this is disappointing, and then it's forever tainted with that. I mean, is it going to do like the Marvel Heroes release idea, where that game that was, you know, the online game, kind of Diablo-esque, kind of launched troubled, then they came out with the next year version so they could get a new Metacritic and, you know, new round of reviews for it. And I think No Man's Sky, I don't know if they create the collector's edition or whatever, but it's hard for people, if you look, oh, that game does sound interesting, what did people say about it, and you look up reviews, they're kind of negative, and they don't, because no one's reviewing the game as it exists right now. It's hard to do.
Yeah. And as much as they said, hey, we're going to continue to update this game, it wasn't positioned as a game like Ark Survival or, you know, Conan Exiles or something where it's, you know, it's like, this is a ongoing thing that is going to continue to be up to it. Was, hey, walk into a store, buy it in a box, and you get it. So, yeah.
Yeah.
So we should probably move on to the playlist, because a lot of fun games to be talking about. But I can't overlook this court story. We got a couple of weeks ago, we got into a big argument about the ZeniMax Oculus thing. And so a lot of people have been sending us updates to that. M. Tucky in the subreddit posted the story, and a lot of people have been emailing and tweeting you and I about that, Christian. The John Carmack has responded to ZeniMax's position on Oculus with his own lawsuit. He is suing ZeniMax for $22.5 million, which I guess is half of what his stock value was when he left in 2009 during the 2009 sale of id to ZeniMax. I know you are not a current lawyer, but do you want to weigh in on this in any way? It feels like a tit for tat to me of, you know, we want money. Okay, fine. Then I'm going to ask for money back. So it feels a little spiteful.
Yeah, it might be. I asked people on Twitter, and you and I kind of talked offline too, if people of this show were interested in me kind of actually taking the time to break down what we talked about last time and why I think there's merit in what ZeniMax is doing. And listeners of this show and you and people said, like, oh, maybe do that as bonus content. And I was like, nah, that's okay. I'm not going to spend the hours required to do that, to put something at the end if people aren't interested in it. That's fine with me. I won't do it. I wouldn't disagree that maybe that this is kind of a tit for tat thing, but this is a totally wholly unrelated issue in terms of, like, this isn't spun out of the same case. This isn't, he thinks he has a claim against them because of something that was said or done. But I could very easily see, you know, this company and this individual seem to have had some bad blood now for a few years, and, you know, claims do eventually expire, and maybe he was finally just fed up with it and just decided, you know what, fine.
I would venture any amount of money to say that if they hadn't sued and won, he wouldn't have levied this lawsuit at all. You know, I feel like this is a direct result of him being ticked off, because if you read what he said about the expert witness of the previous trial, he was pretty upset. Paul, did you want to weigh in on this in any way?
Yeah, I mean, it's been kind of exhausting to try and follow all the backs and forths of this. I just heard about this John Carmack thing, so I don't know kind of the full details of that. But I agree that just from the impressions I get, it does seem like ZeniMax has kind of a point with the whole original lawsuit. I don't know what this John Carmack thing is. It just seems like there's been kind of a lot of stuff brewing with them. And yeah, the fact that they lost probably did kind of put them over the edge in that regard. So I don't know. It's a mess and not really what you want to see from, like, the first major consumer VR product out there.
Yeah.
So hopefully this does not last forever.
Cool. Well, let's move on. We have some awesome games to talk about. As Christian said, it's best March ever. So I do want to thank our sponsor before we move on, Casper. If lawsuits are keeping you up at night, or really anything is keeping you up at night, just, you know, exasperation, you want to get a good night's sleep, you want to sleep soundly, chances are you haven't looked at your mattress in a long, long time. I actually went through all of college on the same mattress and then took it with me when I moved away from college. And I started having these weird issues with my neck and my back. And I was like, I don't know what's going on here. Well, duh, it's a bad mattress. The good news is Casper exists to give you one perfect mattress, and they want to create a way to buy that mattress that doesn't annoy you, because buying mattresses can be very annoying. When you go to the store and you get the hard sell, you know, from the attendants there, and you want to just kind of wander around on your own, and everybody's yelling at you, and you'd want to lay down on the thing, and you test it out, and it's like, okay, well, 5 minutes, I guess I like it. Oh, okay, I'll buy thousands of dollars worth of mattress. Well, Casper solves all those problems. You buy it only online. You're not going to have any commission-driven salesperson on your back. You don't have to decide in 5 minutes. You can decide over 100 nights, because they're going to deliver it free to your house, and you're going to be able to spend 100 nights sleeping on your Casper mattress before you have to decide whether or not you want to keep it. If you don't want it, they'll come back and pick it up, and you'll give a full refund. That's pretty amazing. That's how much they believe in their mattress. And the mattresses are great. There's an in-house team of engineers that has spent thousands of hours developing it, has just the right sink, just the right bounce, breathable design, sleeps cool, keeps you the right temperature throughout the night, and it's at a shockingly fair price. They've eliminated the overhead of the big, you know, big chain stores. They don't have any salespeople to worry about paying. That's why they can keep costs low. And with over 20,000 reviews, with an average of 4.8 stars, we know we love averages. It's quickly becoming the internet's favorite mattress. And you get free shipping in the US and Canada. You can try it for 100 nights. It's great. Plus, we're going to give you $50 off by just going to our URL, which is casper.com/DLC, and using the promo code DLC. So go to casper.com, casper.com/DLC. Use that promo code DLC at checkout. Get yourself $50 off and sleep more soundly. Have a better night's sleep. It is time for the playlist, and man, so many great games to be playing. Paul, you have been playing a lot of Zelda, I'm sure. What do you think? I read your review on Forbes, which was excellent. But tell me what you've been doing lately. Are you still playing it? Have you finished it? Where are you at with Breath of the Wild?
So I've been kind of doing the simultaneous playthrough with two of my other friends. And I think that's kind of the part of the appeal to the game, where my friends and I have this big, long text chain where we're all refusing to Google any answers for anything, but we will ask each other for help.
That's awesome.
So I probably did at least 50, 60 hours this past week, which is nuts. But I'm at like 90-something shrines. I did 3 of the 4 main dungeons, the initial ones. And I knew I wasn't going to finish it before I got my Mass Effect review copy, which just showed up this weekend. So I set it down yesterday, and I'm starting up Mass Effect today, which I can't talk about. But and then I will get back to it and probably beat the entire rest of the game in a week or so once I'm done with Mass Effect.
So are you playing mostly in handheld mode on Switch or on a big screen TV? What control mechanism do you prefer?
I switch back and forth, no pun intended. I'd say split between handheld and TV mode about 50-50, and I would play more in TV mode, except one of the problems with the Switch is that none of its controller options have a headphone jack. And I have a wife who's in school and studying at home, and I work from home, so I play all my games on our TV here, so I kind of need a headphone jack. So when she's around, I just switch over to handheld mode and play it that way. And I don't mind handheld mode. It's fine. I don't like tabletop mode. I think it's too small and you have to sit kind of too far away and crunch yourself up awkwardly. But I really do like handheld mode, so that hasn't been too much of a problem. But I just wish there was a headphone jack.
Well, this week I got the Pro Controller, which at $70 is highway robbery.
Oh my God, it's crazy. It's
unbelievable that they have the gall to charge $69.95 for that controller. It's offensive, and yet I bought it because I'm an idiot, and I also I'm going to tell you that I love it. Which
it's so good.
It's so much better. It's so much better. It improves the game in every way. But for $70, that is just a crime. It is such a crime. But it's made me want to play much more on the big television. And I think it looks really good on the big TV. It really does. Christian, are you playing with the Pro Controller?
When I'm playing on the screen, I do. You just think it's too expensive because you don't use Amiibo. It's that Amiibo support that puts a...
Are you getting your – do you get your sweet companions and your Epona and all that stuff?
I only have Toon Link, so I just get like my little box of meat or whatever.
box of meat.
whatever it drops in.
That is pretty sweet. A toy will get you a box of meat.
I mean, it's great. Everything's perfectly portioned and you can cook it at home. I do – it's too expensive and it's annoying, but – I kind of get why the button layout of the Joy-Cons is set up the way it is, and it's the best portable handheld console in terms of having full controller button parity. But like, it's so silly and trivial, you'd think, but just the difference in having the layout of the Pro Controller going to the D-pad to change weapons or, you know, change your items or whatever, it's such an easier reach to do on the Pro Controller than with the standard Joy-Con, that alone makes a world of difference. And while the Switch is comfortable enough to hold, you forget how unergonomic it is until you're sitting holding an actual controller and you're like, oh yeah, this is how I play this for 5 hours straight. Like, this is the setup.
Yeah, it makes a huge difference, unfortunately. I also had another sort of epiphany about Zelda this week. And, you know, Paul, hearing you talk about like pushing through and how close you are, you're going to finish it up. I have had to divorce myself from the idea of progression in that game. I really have, in order to enjoy it, because as somebody who wants to play everything, feels the pressure to get through things, feels the pressure to like, I want to have an opinion about the entire breadth of this game, no pun intended. And
yes, it was, Jeff. Let's be
okay.
Honest.
Okay. Fair enough. It's a wild thing to try to get through the breadth of this game. I definitely feel like most of the time when I sit down to a game, I need to have those hours mean something. I need to have the time that I'm putting into the game result in movement forward, or I feel anxious. I feel a little frustrated in, oh my God, I wasted 2 hours just climbing to the top of this mountain. There was nothing there. I have had to completely just divorce myself from that feeling, because I've started to think about playing Breath of the Wild like I think about playing Heroes of the Storm. I sit down and I'm just enjoying the mere process of it. There's nothing to do. There's no – another game of Heroes of the Storm isn't going to get me any closer to anything. I mean, I'm definitely trying to rank up, you know, put in my ranked games. But chances are I'm going to move up. I'm going to move down. I'm going to leave this process basically where I was before. I'm just going to have the A, pure joy of playing it, and B, my own skill set is going to improve because I'm having daily practice at this. And I kind of feel like that's what Breath of the Wild is for me at this point. I have to not think about, yeah, maybe I'll sit down and do a couple of shrines. I'll find a couple of shrines, or I'll go and unlock a tower's vision or whatever. And those are palpable things that I can do. But most of the time, I'm just following my curiosity and going, what's over that ridge? Oh, cool. There's some gems that I can smack and get and sell later. There's, oh my gosh, a really weird thing. What's the deal with this weird thing? Oh, I'm going to do that weird thing and then get rewarded with a shrine that pops up out of the ground or something strange. I'm just following my curiosity.
What is your take on that? Really rewards you for following your curiosity, because like, you can just be messing around doing anything and you can stumble upon something cool. Like, there was this one area where there was a big, what's it called, a Hinox, and I'm like, all right, I'll kill this thing. And then when I killed him, he dropped one of those power orbs, and I'm like, oh. So this was a thing. And then it turns out that this was like this little mini shrine quest I'd never heard of, where I had to kill these three giants and walk this, you know, energy ball to these three pedestals. And that was just from me just going somewhere I hadn't been before. And yeah. it's a game that constantly surprises you. And it's interesting to compare it to something like, I'd say like Horizon Zero Dawn, which is another game I really, really liked a lot. But that game never really surprised you. Like it was, you know, you knew by the end, you knew all the monsters, you knew what combat was like, and you weren't going to like stumble across something that was just so cool. And like, it was still fun, but that wasn't really an aspect of the game. Whereas that is almost the entirety of Zelda and kind of the core of its appeal.
Yeah. It's an amazing thing. And I've said before that what I like most about Horizon is how tight an experience it is for an open world game. And what I like about Zelda is how loose an experience it is for an open world game. And if Zelda hadn't come out, I would be saying Horizon is how every open world game should be. They've perfected the open world. They did pacing right. They made everything feel cool and necessary and fun. And there's no filler. And then Zelda comes along. It's like, oh no, there's a completely different take on open world that involves just spreading things out and letting me just kind of experience the world and play inside these systems and making it very loose and unpredictable. Christian, have you put more hours into Zelda this week too?
I have. I'm of several minds of it, having spent more time with it. I think I could still see an argument that it's one of the best games ever created. I think I might even still say it. But I think it's very smart as a Switch game. I think if it were not portable or not able to be played handheld, like if I had it just for the Wii U, I think there's a greater chance I might have bounced off from it. But the fact that I can take it with me, or, you know, my girls are playing and I can just sit down on the couch and just, you know, play for 20 minutes or something like that, makes the game much more appealing to me. I also think the way that it doesn't have what I'll call, and others I think have probably already said too, like the Ubisoft style map of once you go up into the tower, like everything that you can do unlocks, like all those little like pings, you know, all those little places you can go, do this, do that, like checklist type things. You still have to discover them. You have to climb up that mountain and see if something's there. I think that keeps me playing the game, because while it is sometimes frustrating to spend all this time getting to a place only to find nothing, It is, to me, feels less stressful than seeing this huge long list of stuff like, okay, I need to accomplish all these things. But the flip side of that coin is what you said, Jeff. It's climbing to the top of the mountain and finding nothing and having this feeling of like, well, I was doing these quests out of one of the villages and kind of, you know, going along and doing all these little mini quests or whatever I don't even know what they are. Maybe they're main quests at some point. I don't know what's happening. I don't know where I am in the game. I've played a whole bunch of hours and I feel like I'm no closer to completing anything. And I go into battles and I feel under equipped and I don't know if I'm playing the game right, which is fun sometimes, but other times I'm like, what's happening? So I was going through and doing these, what I'll call side missions. And one of them seemed very easy and very basic, and I did it, and then I completed it, and I got a handsome reward, and I was like, oh, sweet, that's a satisfying play experience. And I did this other one that felt pretty long. It wasn't as easy as the others, and then I finished it, and I think I got like 20 rupees, and I was like, are you kidding me?
Well, that's the other thing too, in the way that they have completely changed how loot happens in a Zelda game. You know, in a previous Zelda game, if you found a chest, there was some good stuff in that chest. Now with Zelda, it's like you did a whole thing. You unlocked, you climbed to the top of the thing. You found it. You exploded a wall and oh my gosh, there was a chest in there. What has it got? It's got a broken, half broken thing that
a wood club.
Yeah. No one cares about. It's like, well, oh, okay. I guess that's necessary because I need to have weapons because they're constantly breaking, but yeah, it's not always going to be an awesome reward just because you discovered a chest. But also, there's a billion chests everywhere.
Yeah,
have you done the thing where you take a picture of a chest and then you set that to your sonar? You know, you can set any item that you take a picture of to your sonar, yeah. And you walk around, and it there are chests everywhere. The sonar is constantly pinging. It's like chest near, chest near, chest near. I'm like, I got to turn this off because I can't spend my whole life looking for these stupid chests. It's crazy.
It's incredible and surprising in so many ways. And like Paul said, like the discovery is there, I'd imagine, through all 100 hours. and there's so much, and it's fun to see when systems interact and, oh, I can cut this down and light this on fire and do this or whatever, and the way the world builds on top of itself. But then there are times where I just don't, I feel like I'm playing it wrong, where it's like, I need, this is the thing the game's telling me to do next, but maybe it's because I didn't clear out this village. So I didn't do every little side quest at this village that would open up this other thing. So now I'm trudging through like 10 hours of tundra without any warm clothes to keep me warm. How many peppers can I cook to get to the thing? Then I get to the thing and it's like, here's an easy, battle shrine. And I'm like, easy? Not easy. I've used all of my wooden sticks that I had. Oh, I guess I have to have a sword for this battle, Zelda. Fine. I'm exaggerating, of course, but it's really a beautiful, but also I still think at times frustrating games whose criticisms I will constantly agree with, even if I will still, if I had to score the game, you know, put it in the very high 90s range. It's fascinating. And I think a game that game design will be studying for years. Like, Paul, if you had to level your biggest criticism for the game, what would you be your biggest, even if it's, you know, the Dan Trachtenberg good suck, like what's the thing that holds it back or Zelda 2 will fix?
That's a good question. I think the longer I've played, the more it starts, like, I really like it, and I really do think it's kind of one of the all-time greats, but some of the systems really kind of start to break down over time. You kind of, your quest list is always this kind of weird thing where it's kind of nice to not be given, like, crazily specific objectives and, like, exact waypoints to get everything, but sometimes it goes, like, a little bit overboard in terms of being vague to the point of, like, just total frustration where you're just, like, have to give up a quest. Like, for example, I was doing a side quest the other day where I was told, like, oh, there's a bunch of, you know, moblins riding around on horses in this valley and you have to kill them. And I could see the name of the valley, but it's this huge area. And there was no objective marker. The objective marker is on the quest giver because that's how it works, like 90% of the time for whatever reason. So you just kind of have to go out there.
Frustrating.
I killed about 8 or 9 of these guys. There's no counter to, like, tell me if I've killed enough or, like, how many I'm supposed to kill. And, like, I killed everyone I could see. And so I just kind of wander back and they're like, well, let me know when you take care of the problem. I'm like, what? and then there's a blood moon and then they all come back again. And it's like, what? And like, there's another quest that's on my list. That's just, it's literally like, I talked to this girl in the village and it's like, this girl is bored. Like, that's the quest. And I'm like, what do I do with that? So, like, in a way, it's been nice because I kind of just haven't had to let some of these go. And, like, eventually when I do start, like, Googling answers, I guess I'll get back to them. But
that's how life is, though, Paul. Sometimes a girl is just bored. Sometimes you don't know how many moblins you need to murder before the townspeople are happy. That's just how life is. Nobody knows that 10 moblins is going to be the answer to the problem. It's just, like, no, there's still a problem with the moblins.
Yeah.
P.S. though, that girl wasn't bored. All these people are so horny. Have you guys...
Oh, is it just me? Of the sound effects? Yeah.
And what they say. They're like, oh, you're cute. No, you can stay at my village for free. And I'm like, what?
there's a lot of that. Like, all throughout the game.
Yeah. You mentioned Ubisoft, Christian, and, you know, we saw last year that there was the annual releases of Assassin's Creed, you know, they took a year off and they're going to come back strong this year. Surprising no one, I'm sure there will be a massive announcement at E3 of the next Assassin's Creed. I just have this vision of the offices wherever the, I guess Montreal, wherever the
all of them, you mean all over the world,
right? Yeah, exactly. Where they got Zelda and they're like, oh no, oh, we need to change some things real quick. This new Assassin's Creed needs to back to the drawing board.
No, they just sent out an email to all of their dev teams and they all hit Control A to select every little marker in it and then just hit delete and then they ship the game like that.
Also, I think this is a good segue. We were talking about awesome moments. We got a Story of Glory. Remember the Stories of Glories and Tales of Fails we used to do on the show? Jordan sent this in. He's bringing back Stories of Glories. He has a Zelda Story of Glory, and it's a game where, man, it's just built around creating Stories of Glories and Tales of Fails. This comes from Jordan. He says, my first real boss fight, I didn't really prepare my equipment as well as I should have, but on my second or third try, I got the boss down to a sliver of health. Every single bow I brought with me was now broken. and I only had a single sword left. Even though I had plenty of food and hearts to spare, I was at a complete dead end since my weapons dwindled down to nothing. The boss was out of reach, and I had almost nothing to hit him with. A last-ditch idea struck me. I had a strength potion available, but knew that drinking it would cancel out my vital defense-increasing potion. Taking that risk was my only option. I drank the strength potion and equipped my final sword, a large, unwieldy lunk of a thing that wasn't as powerful as I'd like. I got as close as possible to the boss without getting hit. I locked on, held the R button, carefully aimed as best I could, and threw the sword through the air. It connected. The boss was dead. A last-ditch Hail Mary throw took off the final sliver of the boss's health. There were 100 different ways this fight could have gone, countless strategies to exploit, now probably missing a bunch that I could have still done despite having nothing apparently available to me. But the way the systems multiply together enable the experiences in Breath of the Wild to be uniquely my own. I love that Breath of the Wild allows you to fail by running out of weapons. It forces you to think on your toes, to think through preparations, and it rewards you for creativity. I think that says it very well.
And Go ahead.
No, please.
I was going to tell my own tale of fail. I'll try to be as dramatic as you were. So I set up to do this side quest, and I talked to the NPC characters in the game, and I suffered through the non-voice acting, but it was fine. Whatever. That's not a big deal. I'm not going to harp on that on this email. Anyway, love the show. First-time listener.
I love the show. First-time listener. Long-time caller. First-time
listener. Long-time co-host. First-time listener. As I listened to the instructions from the NPC for this side quest, it seemed like a most epic side quest. I was excited to go on the voyage, but then I hearkened back to my memory and recollection of prior Zelda games in which talking to the same NPC could yield different instructions. In fact, you could get more information the more times you talked to NPCs until it was no longer a riddle you were facing, but a simple fetch quest. So with this in mind, I went back to the same NPCs and I pressed A, actually the first time I pushed B because that Nintendo controller still frustrates me. After backing out of the conversation, instead of having the conversation, I went back to those same NPCs, pressed A, and engaged in the conversation. Lo and behold, the conversation was different. I thought I was going to get new information. So when the option came up for me to reply, I had one of two choices. One was to end the conversation altogether, and the other was to confirm an action that I hadn't actually done, but that was my option to say that I did it. I selected this option, hoping I would gain new information from the NPC characters, at which point they said, "You did it. Congratulations." Then flashing up on the screen, it said, "Side quest completed," and I received nothing. I have no clue what happened.
All right.
And I can't do it.
But that's not a tale of failure. You did it, man.
I didn't do anything.
You probably had an item that they wanted that they were like telling you to get, but then you already just had it. So you probably just like handed it to them.
They didn't take anything from me. Like, I have no clue what happened. It was so weird. It was so weird.
It's like life, man. Sometimes the girl's just bored.
She's not bored, Jeff, by the way. She's on Tinder.
You brought up the voice acting thing, which we talked about at length last week. We got a lot of feedback about that. There's an awesome thread in the subreddit, people debating back and forth about the voice acting. I can't wait to hear what Paul thinks about it, but I want to read this email that we got from Michael. This was sent to dlcfeedback@gmail.com. He says, "Hey guys, I love the show from the beginning and before, but I want to take a moment to disagree with your position on the limited voice acting in Zelda Breath of the Wild. I think it is absolutely a stylistic choice that has merit. It has some drawbacks as well, but so does the alternative. I'll use Fallout 4 as a counterexample. I love the level of immersion the full voice acting brings, but the downside is that for mundane conversations like with a shopkeeper or someone I interact with frequently, I hear the same dialogue repeatedly and that can be more irritating than reading it repeatedly. In Zelda, I like that they include voice acting for important cutscenes, but also like that much of the in-game dialogue is still read rather than acted. It lets me put some of my own interpretations on a character, like the difference between reading a book or listening to it narrated, and that I can either fly through it as fast as I read it or pause to make mental note about what they are saying and whether or not I feel like I'm missing the pace of the dialogue. Zelda is a very stylized world, and I don't need every character to be painstakingly acted out. I like them as simple characters with simple needs. I also think it works especially well for a silent protagonist that you are seeing in third person during these brief conversations. Another stylistic choice I hope Zelda franchise keeps. Zelda could maybe have a little more voice dialogue, but overall, I still greatly enjoy reading a lot of it. Keep up the great work.
What is your feeling on that, Paul? My contention was that it's a bit of a vestige of a bygone era, and it kind of holds Zelda back a little bit from being a completely modern game. What's your take on the voice acting?
Oh, man, I think it's a complicated issue, because if there was one aspect where, like, Zelda or Breath of the Wild is kind of lacking, and indeed kind of a lot of Zelda games, it is kind of story and characters. Like, you're on this epic quest to save the world, but you're not really that invested in each of these individual characters, because they often don't talk, or if they do, it's like a couple cutscenes. If they really wanted to go deep with it and, like, write this huge script and have it fully voice acted, I think that might help that aspect. But I guess you kind of have to ask yourself, like, is that really what Zelda is? And in its current form in Breath of the Wild, I think it is kind of good that you know, just talking to every shopkeeper, you don't have to sit through their their dialogue, or, like, just passes by in the street. I think maybe the voice acting is a bit too limited, because it is in some cutscenes, but then the cutscenes are just a minute long, and then you will be, you know, continuing your conversation with King whoever, and then suddenly he's not voice acting anymore, and it's weird. Yeah. I do not think that – I think only bad things are going to happen if they ever try and give Link a voice, which I am all in favor of voice protagonists in pretty much every series. Zelda, I don't think that's going to go well, no matter how you cut it. And, like, I'm not even the biggest fan of kind of Zelda's voice acting in Breath of the Wild. So I'm not sure if adding Link to that would be kind of a solution.
As long as they get Gilbert Gottfried as Link in
The Legend of Zelda. That'd be perfect, yes.
Yeah, I was thinking about this a lot this week, and I'm starting to think that maybe the problem isn't necessarily voice acting or not voice acting. It's the fact that we've all decided the convention in video games where you walk up to someone, you have a complete conversation with them standing in one spot as you both stand in one spot staring at each other. And I understand that's, you know, a video game is here's where the character lives. I'm going to walk up to that character and I'm going to start a conversation. But no human being does that. That is not how life works. It's not how any other visual medium presents a conversation. No one stands staring at each other face to face and has long, drawn out conversations. And I don't understand why video games haven't figured out a way to make that more dynamic and more interesting. Why in role-playing games, BioWare games, for example, or, you know, Bethesda games, when I'm hearing the entire life story of a character, why are we just standing at and staring at each other? Why, even in Horizon Zero Dawn, why am I just, as beautiful as that game is and as beautiful as the character models are and everything, at a certain point, I'm done staring into the eyes of this CG character or studying the lovely, you know, wardrobe choices that they've made. Why can't there be a solution that makes a more dynamic conversation? Why can't we figure out a way to do the Aaron Sorkin walk and talk in video games or something?
Well, I mean, you mentioned BioWare, and I think, you know, BioWare games are, like, more recently, you know, Final Fantasy 15, their kind of solution to that is when you're out in a party, you kind of have these conversations on the go,
right?
Where maybe they're not the most meaningful conversations in the world, but it's a way to kind of at least flesh out the characters just as you're walking. Or, like, in Mass Effect, like the old Mass Effects, like if you're walking through the Citadel and, you know, your companion just comments on something. In terms of why you can't do that with more characters that are kind of stationary, my guess would be it's just kind of an animation problem, because, like, as soon as you have to script a scene where you and an NPC are walking and talking, then that becomes a cutscene, essentially.
Sure.
And when you have, you know, 500 characters in a game that you have to talk to, they're only going to be able to do that with kind of a handful of them. So my guess is it's a time constraint. And, like, I agree, it's not great. And if I have to stare, like, dead-eyed into the face of one more Bethesda character, like, I'm going to lose it. But
yeah,
there are some kind of mini solutions that they're trying, maybe a little bit.
Well, in the chat room, could432 brings up the fact that Rockstar does this really well. They eschew that almost completely, and I think that's right. And the solution is generally what you're talking about, Paul, which is, like, all of their dialogue scenes are either cutscenes or full cutscenes, or you're in a car and we're talking back and forth on your way somewhere. And I think that's an interesting perspective. It's very true that Rockstar doesn't really have the, like, stand there and stare at someone for a while.
So kudos to them, I suppose. Christian, what's your take on this?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with a lot of what Paul said. I think it is unfortunate, and it's the thing that we kind of say, yeah, but video games, like, we give it a pass, and hopefully we'll see less of it as the medium continues to evolve and the tech grows. I mean, I think that might be part of the reason why I still am drawn to the linear narrative games, that they don't suffer from that as much. You know, Joel and Ellie rarely are standing looking at each other going over shoulder, wide two, over shoulder. Like, they're doing stuff, but they can do that because they can have those conversation be bridges between areas, whereas a lot of these games like Mass Effect, Zelda, or, you know, Horizon Zero Dawn, where you're at like a hub area, you're at a village, you're getting these side missions, you know, what are you going to do with that? The way that game is structured, like, here's the thing, then you go out to the world to bring back to this thing, like, your walk and talk would be like, hey, let me tell you my life story, and while we do it, we'll walk this tight circle around my home. which, true. You know, again, that, but again, it's a problem of video game design where all of these things are coming together where games are, I think you said maybe last week how, oh no, it was on Slash Film. All of your media that I listen to, Jeff, I get, it's all one thing. And sometimes I think they're conversations we have. Maybe this was the idea that comics have moved, you know, in the 80s or 90s, comics were like, hey, we're not just this anymore. We can tell real stories with these characters. And video games are very much in that now, but they're also still video games. So they suffer from video gamey problems. Horizon Zero Dawn is an incredible game with an incredible narrative and an awesome open world combat style of gameplay. But at the same time, I can crouch in tall reeds of red grass and go and kill a guy, and then one guy is like, hey, body over here. Yeah, kill a guy. Uh-oh, two bodies over here. Yeah. And they don't alert anyone. And like, that game has taught me that if in real life I'm ever out in the nature and I hear a whistle and don't see where it's coming from, walk the opposite direction. Like, never walk toward the whistle. Or I think I'll talk about it a little more later this show, Nier Automata. It's a Platinum Games developed thing, and it very much has that thing of, and God of War suffered from this too, where it's like, you're in this awesome expanse, you're trying to figure out where to go and what to do, and so I can make that jump, I have this double jump, I have this guy that can help me, here I go, run, jump, just kidding, invisible wall, like, you can't go that way, we're not gonna let you fall down that way, yeah, but video games, by the way, go this way. And so all of this stuff hopefully will get fixed, but I think we forgive it because it's so much better today than it was even just 5 years ago.
Yeah, I think that's probably a good time to transition into Nier. I want to hear you talk about it. You gave me several texts this week saying, oh my gosh, Jeff, you would dig this game. But too much to play, Christian. There's too much to play.
There really is. So I'm maybe 5 hours into it. If you know nothing about it, it's Square Enix, action RPG, Platinum Games developed. And it's, if you are bummed on the recent Platinum Games, the licensed games, Ninja Turtles and Transformers, but you love Bayonetta or Bayonetta 2, holy moly, this game is for you. Like, it's, remember how when we talked about Gravity Rush 2 and I complained that it was Japanesey in a way that I don't like, that was just like, what's, it's like, wah, 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 and I was like, what is happening? It's like random and weird. Like, this is very, again, I'm being reductive here, but very that traditionally Japanese developed style of video game. But in the style of things that I enjoy, some of the stuff I still kind of cringe at, like when you're running as your character, like you're constantly peeking at her butt, like her skirt just doesn't cover it. It's like constant, like an upskirt tease. And I'm just like, I got a family. I can't play this game. Even if, you know, I have headphones on, so I don't hear what, it's just like, it's just, you're playing peekaboo. It's odd. But the combat, that classic Platinum combat, the light and heavy two button with a button to evade slash also if timed perfectly allows you to unleash your flurry of your counter. It's so smooth and it's so good. And it's, you know, it's that Team Ninja style it started and then Platinum evolved of just the visceral, awesome action combat. But now this game with Square Enix's, I'm assuming, guidance gets the open world RPG treatment that a lot of the Platinum games haven't had done well before, and it does it very well. It's traditional in the sense that you go to a village and you get main quests and side quests and you go out and execute them and do whatever. But then when you're going out on these missions in this open world, you're doing that awesome Platinum combat. So it's like, yeah, okay, this is really fun and engaging open world combat versus for me in Breath of the Wild, I oftentimes run by it because I'm like, it's fine, but I don't want to break this weapon. This is like, oh yeah, game on. Here's this combo. I'm going to get these points. I'm going to upgrade my guy. Everything's constantly leveling up the way those games do. But then it has a full RPG, you know, bring pieces back to your base to further upgrade your weapons and do things. And I'm maybe a third or halfway through my first playthrough of the game, I'm guessing. But it has multiple endings. So you get like all the endings, like the best endings, you kind of need to complete it three specific ways. I'm never going to do that. I don't see how it's going to happen, but it is so cool. The story it's telling is really neat, where it's this world of, you know, humanity no longer exists, but you're playing as an android, but you're competing against these robots. All of these open world games right now are, you know, futuristic societies that have had machines go awry, right? It's like, yeah. Which one am I playing again? But it's told in a...
Somebody who I heard this week referred to Breath of the Wild as post-apocalyptic Hyrule, which yeah. is totally accurate. I never thought of it that way, but it's totally true. Anyway, sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. No problem. It's just so... It's so cool to see great Platinum again. Like, I love Bayonetta and Bayonetta 2, and now to have this game come out and do all of that quirky Platinum, you know, Eastern developed style gameplay and do it so well again, and then add in, if you want and you have the time, and I wish it didn't come out in March, all of the deeper traditional RPG systems is really, really cool. And the last thing I'll say about it is it doesn't autosave, and it tells you, and it's hard. I'm playing on normal. My gaming background, like games like Ninja Gaiden, are fairly easy for me. I'm pretty good at that style of action combat. This game will kick your butt, and it's supposed to, and it tells you again and again, like, hey, we don't autosave. You got to find a save point. And it tells you when you start up the game, it says, this game does not autosave. Play the game to figure out how to save. And when I saw that, I like, you know, figuratively cracked my knuckles, and I was like, all right, Platinum, game on. Let's do this. Let's see what you got. And then my first hour, I got to the first boss battle. I had not learned how to save. I died, and I was like, well, that's no problem. I'm in a boss battle. I'll start the boss over again. The game was like, nope, you'll start the whole game over again. And I was like, Platinum, one win for you on that. I accept your challenge. But I'm not saying play it now, because I know people, like, it's not a new IP, but it's not Mass Effect, it's not Zelda, but plant a flag in it. Go in, you know, click R3, zoom in on the shrine, mark it, and come back to Nier if you're looking for something to play later or now. It's fantastic.
Wow. I gotta have to come back to that one. Paul, anything else on your playlist that you've been playing other than Zelda? Or are you just, you know, 60 hours is what you've been doing?
I played about 20 minutes of Ghost Recon Wildlands before my Switch showed up. I literally switched over.
Yeah.
It's been mostly Zelda. I play Hearthstone pretty consistently. It's just kind of my go-to when there's nothing else going on. Yeah, other than that, now I'm starting at Mass Effect, like, just today.
Yeah.
So you kind of sold me on Nier. That sounds pretty incredible. So I'm looking forward to getting that in, I don't know, 4 months or something.
Right. Well, I had another distraction, another game I think, unfortunately, coming out at this time, probably going to be overlooked by a lot of people, but it's a really, really worthwhile diversion from the big hitters. It's called Loot Rascals, and it just came out on PlayStation 4 and PC. I'm playing it on PC. It's a delight. It is everything I love. I mean, it's kind of got tabletop aesthetics. It's a card-based combat system, card-based loot system, and a turn-based movement system. You're on a hexagonal grid, and you can move around freely. When you push the stick, your little dude can walk around freely without clicking a new turn, because it is turn. All everything's turn-based. But as soon as you, like, cross the border of the hex into another hex, that's when the turns. And I don't know, I thought that was kind of a cool little innovation, that it doesn't feel so static as a turn-based game, because you're able to move and everything. And then once you slide past that demarcation line, now you've started a new turn. Anyway, the whole aesthetic of the game is
great. If you guys haven't seen Loot Rascals before now, it's got this sort of Adult Swim animated vibe and really fun voice acting and really wild, over the top, wacky kind of creatures and monsters and stuff. And what you're doing, you crash land on this alien planet, you and your Scottish AI buddy, and you have to try to eliminate the monsters. And as you eliminate them, you get new loot. The loot comes in the form of cards that you add to your tableau. You have a deck of cards that you can place into a tableau. You've got a top line of cards and a bottom line of cards that constitute your inventory. And you can have cards that boost your attack and boost your defense, and then also cards that do certain special things, special attacks or special rule-breaking things. And where you place them in that tableau often will have impact on their effectiveness. So if certain cards will work better if they're on the top row or the bottom row or in a even-numbered slot or an odd-numbered slot or adjacent to another type of card. So there's strategy in laying out your cards in your deck and which ones you use and how much attack versus how much defense. And then as you're playing on the hexagonal grid, there's a day and night cycle. So 5 turns for day, 5 turns for night. And the creatures will either attack you first or you will attack them first. And that will oscillate between day and night. So a creature that attacks you first during the day, you will attack first at night. So you only want to attack the creatures in the state that is most advantageous to you, because you can get all your attacks off and kill them before they even attack you. So it's got this like Pac-Man kind of thing where they're moving and you're moving. You're trying to anticipate where they're going to move so that you can either head them off at the pass to initiate an attack or avoid them until it turns from night to day to then initiate the attack. So it's a fun little like cat and mouse thing where you're, wandering around this map and there's movement happening with all the creatures and you're trying to figure out which ones you want to hit and which ones you don't. And getting all the loot is delightful because they drop loot and you can get cards that like overlay on other cards and create cool compound effects. It's awesome. It's a quick little diversion game that I could see myself putting many, many hours into if there weren't these gigantic games requesting all of my attention. But but man, this game would be so great on Switch. It would be so perfect on a portable system like that. I would play it way, way more. I mean, it reminds me of Rogue Legacy or something like that in that sense. I mean, it is a roguelike. You're trying to see how long you can last before you die, and you can die pretty quickly because you start with only 5 hit points. Hey, man, it's a great, great game that unfortunately I think a lot of people are going to overlook because there's so many big AAA games coming out. But do not miss Loot Rascals if any of the stuff I've said sounds interesting, because it's really fun and well made. Christian, you want to mention 1-2 Switch real quick or no?
Oh, yeah. Also, I forgot to mention it up top. I apologize. This episode, there's bonus content. Oh, I interviewed the composers of Halo Wars 2, and it's really, really cool. Really cool chat of kind of what went into it. And I love the score and the music for Halo Wars 2. I think it's so strong, especially while you're playing, but also the stuff that goes underneath the blur cinematics. And they kind of talked about the difference between that and really, really cool chats at the end of this episode. So please listen to that. Stay tuned for that. My review of 1-2 Switch is it 1-2 sucks. It's not good.
All right.
It's not. I played for 10-15 minutes with my wife and we giggled some because of the forced eye contact. And then we said at the same time, we're like, yeah, I'm done. Don't buy it, I guess would be my, it's fine. It's fine. You know what it is.
Yeah. And, fair enough. We don't have to spend a lot of time on it. Yeah. It's not $50 worth.
No.
I'll skip VR talk today, although I did try out the watching 3D Blu-rays in PSVR, which works surprisingly well. It's really good. And I'm still playing a lot of Robo Recall. You can listen to NLB, Newest Latest Best, on Anchor if you want to hear me talk more about that stuff. I do want to get to quick questions because those are a big hit. People are loving them and sending them in. But I need to thank our second sponsor, which is Fireside. If you are a podcaster or have aspirations to become a podcaster, you really should know about Fireside, because Fireside is a podcast hosting and analytics platform that was created by podcasters for podcasters. The guy who created this network, the 5x5 network, his name is Dan Benjamin. He's been podcasting since 2009, and he took everything he learned in those years of podcasting and created Fireside. Fireside has everything you would want: unlimited uploads, unlimited downloads, massive amounts of real-time data and analytics to tell you about your unique downloads, and a super fast CDN for the best download speeds. Multiple podcast support. So if you want to do multiple shows, it's got your back. Free one-click podcast importing. So if you're already doing shows on platforms like Libsyn, Feedpress, Simplecast, and SoundCloud, one click brings them into Fireside. Custom domain mapping, a beautiful responsive website with all your own artwork, host and guest pages, and tons of advanced features like sponsorship integration, chapter markers, a bookmarklet for links, auto posting of future episodes, time code linking, and so much more. Also, you can try Fireside for free for 7 days, during which time you can import your existing podcasts for free while taking advantage of every feature that Fireside has to offer. The unlimited plan starts at just $19 a month, and there's no commitment or long-term agreement to worry about. So try it today. Fireside.fm/DLC is where you can go to take a tour. And if you use the promo code DLC, you get 20% off the standard plan for 3 months. So if you've ever dreamed about becoming a podcaster, it could not be easier. Go to fireside.fm/DLC. Use that promo code DLC. You get 20% off. Fireside, by podcasters for podcasters. All right, now it's time for quick questions. You can always send your quick questions to dlcfeedback@gmail.com. There's also a stickied thread on our subreddit, 5x5dlc.reddit.com. Quick question, guys. This comes from Dan from St. Louis, Missouri. Normal or inverted? Paul?
Normal.
Me too. I think inverted people are weird and should be shunned. Christian?
Next question.
I'm inverted.
Old. I know that you're older than me, Jeff. I feel like that used to be the default, and I just kind of learned that way.
It's never the default.
On
if
consoles.
If you played flight simulators, it was the default.
No, like on GoldenEye. Oh, I feel like it was.
You're weird.
I am weird. But you're a lefty. You have a left-handed mouse, you freak.
I am a left-handed. Yeah, I'm a freak. Quick question. This comes from Andrew. He says, if you had to pick one PlayStation-only game for a first-time PlayStation owner to play that isn't Uncharted or The Last of Us, what would it be?
PS4?
I can start. Yeah, PS4.
Okay.
I can start, I will say
Horizon Zero Dawn?
Well, Horizon Zero Dawn's the easy one, I guess. But I was going to say Infamous, Second Son.
Okay.
What about you, Paul?
That's a good one. I was going to say Horizon Zero Dawn because I guess that's the easy one. But it's, I mean,
sorry.
It's open world, and it's the best you can do in open world these days, except Zelda. So I definitely would recommend it.
Christian?
The Uncharted Collection, I think. It's a really good...
that isn't Uncharted or The Last of Us.
It's not. It's all of the Uncharted. If this is PlayStation 4 only, I'd probably say PlayStation All-Stars, just to give you a taste of all of them.
Really?
No. Oh, God, no.
You're the worst.
Definitely not. If this is... I think I still might say it, even though it's not the best version of it. Or it's a good version, but it's weird because it's a third. But God of War 3, if it's PlayStation only, I would say... if it's PlayStation in general, I would say God of War. If it's PlayStation 4, I still might say God of War 3 because that's such a strong franchise in the console history.
All right. Well, also, so you're terrible at this question.
That's a good answer. God of War 3 was... Last of Us, you're the one that said PlayStation 4. His question doesn't say it. Last of Us was PlayStation 3.
All right. Well, if he's a new PlayStation owner, he didn't go out and buy a PS2.
If you had to pick one PlayStation only game for a first-time PlayStation owner.
All right. Quick question. This one comes from Brent. He says, will there be a Switch XL? When? Paul?
I think there will be a Switch XS. I think they're going to do a handheld-only version at some point. That's my prediction.
Replace the 3DS? That's the idea?
I just wrote a thing about this today. Like, the Switch is replacing the 3DS. Like, they're not saying that, and, like, everyone's dancing around that. But, like, if you've used a Switch, you can tell it's, like, kind of the next handheld, in my opinion.
I agree.
I think they're going to separate it out from the dock and sell it a little cheaper. They may do an XL as well. I don't really think it needs to get much bigger if it wants to stay portable. So maybe that's not the best idea.
I think there will be a Switch XL, but it won't be a physically larger, it will be a hard drive larger.
Oh, okay.
I think the Switch XL is going to be, it's going to have like a, you know, it'll bump up to a 250 gigabyte hard drive, which is still way too small. but at least, you know, usable. And I think that'll happen relatively soon. I think we're going to see that in like a year, year and a half. Christian, what do you think? Switch XL?
There's going to be a Switch redesign, a Switch Slim, Switch 2.0, whatever they want to call it. I don't think it'll necessarily get bigger. But I agree with you, Jeff, that I think we could see this revision within a year, year and a half for sure.
Quick question. This is from Monkey Mind in the chat, in the subreddit. Quick question. The devil has challenged you to a 1v1 gaming battle for your soul, as he does. You can choose any game to play against him and hopefully save yourself. What's your pick? Which game do you have the most skills at? Paul?
Super Smash Brothers 64, Kirby only.
Kirby only. I like the stipulation. Yeah. Christian, how about you?
NFL Blitz 2000 on the Dreamcast.
Boy. See, I would want to say Heroes of the Storm, but now I need four people to defend my soul with me because there's no one-on-one, 1v1. So it says a 1v1 gaming battle. I'm probably going to have to do OG Street Fighter 2.
Okay.
Yeah. But I really would rather Heroes of the Storm.
just for the record, while we did a best out of three, or no, best out of five, I think it was, and you won three of those. I mean, I'm not the devil, but I beat you in Street Fighter 2.
But you beat me one game out of...
Right, but I'm not claiming it to be my best 1v. I'm just saying.
Let's play Heroes of the Storm, Christian.
I'd love to. I'll be on your team.
all right. That has been Quick Questions. And that is going to wrap up our show. I know that those people who have been missing Tabletop Time... I hear you. I've gotten lots of your emails and tweets. Please give a chance to newest, latest, best. When we have, we will continue to talk about board games on the show, I promise. But it's going to be much less often because now there's another outlet for that. So check out newest, latest, best on Anchor. Today's episode, Monday, is all about board games. So I hear you, but I got your back. Don't you guys worry. All right, that's it for this episode. We do have a parting gift coming up. And as Christian mentioned, there is bonus content, which is really, really cool. You should check out. But Paul Tassi, thank you for being here. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Where can people follow your writings and internet personality online?
I'm just at Paul Tassi on Twitter. And my Forbes site is just forbes.com/site/insertcoin is my column page.
Very cool. It's good stuff there, man. In fact, Christian, I would highly recommend, based on some of your frustration that you have mentioned with Zelda, I highly recommend reading his article about the two skills in Zelda that break the game. It's really good. It's a good article. Christian, how about you? What do you got going on this week?
Well, there are new marriages sketches on my YouTube, which is, again, Christian Spicer 713. They have their own dedicated playlist, too, where you can see the four originals and the three new ones. So you can check those out. I do a parenting podcast called Department of Parenting. And spoiler, this week's the show drops on Tuesdays and Thursdays. My wife guests with Chris Quintos and I for both of them. I think it might be her first podcast appearance. So there's that. And then I do another geek-centric show called At Least 20 More Minutes, which you can find at patreon.com/Christian Spicer. Last week's episode was my Switch review, kind of, I guess I should call it a review in progress, because that's what everything is now these days. I did a Logan spoiler-free review. I'm going to do, Jeff, I want you and I to talk Logan, because I did listen to that Slash Film cast review. And while I, too, really liked the film, I think you and I would have an interesting talk, whereas on Slash Film cast, they were like, are you done? And you were like, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know. Are you saying that you would disagree with me or you would agree with me?
I think I would agree with you. And I think we could find, though, by through our agreement of not liking certain aspects, I think we might come out liking it more, if that makes sense.
I got a phone call from Brian Brushwood, who was like, I need to talk to you about why you're wrong about Logan. So a lot of people are,
Interesting. Well, I think you're right.
Well, I appreciate that. That's very, very rare. In fact, I might have to pull out that
soundbite and use it later.
Nope. Only this one specific instance. and then Twitter's the easiest way to get in touch with me. It is at Spicer. My album still exists. We're All Gonna Die. iTunes, Amazon, Google. People seem to love it. So you can buy that.
I have several other shows for you to listen to. The aforementioned / Filmcast, where we did review Logan. In fact, we also put out our review of Kong Skull Island a little early, which has more discussion of Logan in the After Dark part of the episode. So check that out at /filmcast.com. And I have a comedy science show called We Have Concerns, which you can find at wehaveconcerns.com. I guested on Kind of Funny. It wasn't this week. It's coming out this week. It was during GDC. I guess they're having a bunch of crazy stuff. Colin quit this morning. So I had nothing to do with that. I promise. A lot of people are blaming me in a weird way. If you look at their YouTube, it's all discussion of that. And
so when do you start?
Yeah, I wish. No. I wish. That'd be great. I would make some money, but no. But anyway, you can watch those. It was really fun. I was on the Game Over Greggy show. So we weren't really talking video games. We were talking all kinds of life stuff. We talked about being a dad and it's good. It's good stuff. Also, I've been mentioning the Anchor show I'm doing, Newest, Latest, Best, every single day. They only exist for 24 hours. That has been a bit of a frustration for some people. And I'm thinking about perhaps compiling. That's combine and compile made into one word, which is what you do when you combine and compile things. I'm thinking of putting them all out as at the end of the week. So if there's demand for that, let me know. I can make that happen and we will move forward on that. But right now, 24 hours to listen to them on the Anchor app. There's call-ins and really cool way to interact. So check that out over at anchor.fm. And that's going to be it. We're going to move on now to wrap the show up with our parting gift. Hey, give us a suggestion of what to do this week. Give us a parting gift. This is your parting gift. Oh, Paul, do you have a suggestion that might not be a video game to get people through their week?
Sure. I highly suggest anyone who likes video games give Lucha Underground a shot if they haven't already. It's a Mexican professional wrestling show that is the closest thing we'll ever get to like a real life fighting game because of how ridiculous it is. But it's pretty awesome, actually. I like it a lot.
Yeah, I do too. Pretty wild, over the top, wonderful costuming, wonderful athleticism. Good stuff. Christian, how about you? What is your parting gift?
I started watching the Mick on Fox. I went into it like, oh, I guess I need to stay abreast with current sitcoms for, you know, my writing. And then I found myself really, really enjoying it. So I think it's easy to kind of shrug off a network sitcom for a lot of people, especially when there's so much good stuff on HBO or Netflix or FX, AMC. There's so many things demanding for our time, but it's good. It's definitely a sitcom, but it's enjoyable and it has its heartfelt moments as well, as long with its dumb, you know, ridiculous sitcom pieces. But I've been enjoying it.
This is the one with what's her name from It's Always Sunny, right?
Yes.
Love her. She's great. Although I can't remember her name. I have another television show to recommend. It's called Apple Tree Yard. It's a BBC show, only 4 episodes. Oh man, my wife and I were hooked on this thing. It is amazing. Emily Watson. It is dark and very heavy. Heavy is the word I'm looking for. But also very, very good. It's a woman in a marriage, kind of starts an affair and crazy things happen from there. But it is so honest. Her performance is absolutely staggering. Highly, highly recommend this, based on a novel, Apple Tree Yard. See if you can find it. It's pretty great. All right. That's it for this episode of DLC. Thanks to Paul Tassi and Christian Spicer for hanging out with me. Thanks to all the folks in the chat room that were hanging out with us and making the show better in real time. Thanks to our music contributors, Patrick L., Sean Madigan, and Zero Star. Thanks to all of you for downloading this episode and listening to it. We appreciate your kind reviews on your platform of choice, and we appreciate you sharing this with your friend. We will be back next week. Until then, think about what you put out into the world. Make it a better place.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to this bonus content of DLC. I am super excited to be having this discussion. One, because I'm a big fan of their work. And two, I know nothing about it. I don't know how it's done. I could never imagine doing it. So I feel like I'm going to get smarter today. I am joined by Gordy Hobb. Hello.
Hi there. How's it going?
Brian Lee White. Hello.
Hey.
And Brian Trifon. Hello.
Hi. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you guys?
Doing great.
Yeah. Great.
Not bad.
If we could you guys each say your name and then your title so I can get it as directly and clearly as possible and I don't need to make something up like composer, conductor, an instrumenter, like who you are, what your business card would say, and then what you do. Gordy, we'll start with you.
Sure. My name is Gordy Hobb and I'm a composer and orchestrator.
Cool. Brian, Mr. White.
Hi, I am Brian Lee White. I am a composer, a producer, and a cat wrangler.
Great. Mr. Trifon.
Yes, I'm Brian Trifon. I'm a composer and musical sound designer.
Awesome. Thank you, guys. Question one, do you guys play video games? Gordy, we'll start with you.
Yeah, I do. But I'm actually kind of really into the old games. I still even have my old game systems, and you know, I actually like sport games probably more than anything. But yeah, I definitely play.
So you're like Sega Genesis, NHL 94, you and Kevin Smith going to the boards?
Exactly. I actually still have my Sega Genesis. Not that I ever actually use it, but you know, I like playing sport games. I'm like into Madden and
Yeah, cool. White, what about you?
Yeah, I mean, I played a lot of video games in the 80s and 90s, so I like a lot of those classic games too. Now, the games I'm into, I'm really into like ambient games, so like Inside, you know, anything that's kind of got like a mood, like walking simulators, like I really liked Firewatch that came out last year. So stuff like that I'm more into than like the shooters, just kind of stuff I can kind of decompress with and chill out and kind of just explore.
Yeah, of course. Trifon, what about you?
Yeah, so I play games. I stay up on the current games, but similar to Gordy, I think my favorites are sort of retro gaming. I have one of those like retro pie like emulator machines that has like all the Super Nintendo, all the Genesis, all the like Neo Geo and arcade games. So that's my jam, is like playing some old Nintendo games and old arcade games and things like that.
Awesome. Yeah. So for people that don't know your work, I mean, you guys have quite an extensive resume of work in the video game space. Gordy, you wrote music for Halo Wars 2. All of you guys worked on Halo Wars 2. You also did Star Wars Battlefront, The Old Republic, Walking Dead, Survival Instinct, to name a few. Brian's, you guys worked on Master Chief Collection, Double Fine's Massive Chalice, and Tilt Brush, right, for the HTC Vive and Google. Holy crap, one. Two, talk about working under pressure. You guys are working on games and franchises that have defined music and score and atmosphere and tone over the years, and things that I think any quote unquote gamer could hum instinctively. And now here you are tasked with working on Halo Wars 2, which everyone knows Halo's score, right? That right. The credits come up, Halo starts. So you need to be true to that. But it's a new game. You're not just taking old work and control C, control V, wipe your hands, get paycheck, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
So I mean, when you go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, I think like when I actually, one of the main reasons I was brought onto this project was because of my experience working with, you know, a lot of the Star Wars video games and already having lived in a world where you have to step up to an existing franchise and still deliver. You know, live within an existing sound and, you know, please a ton of fans that already exist. So, you know, coming on to Halo, it was, you know, a big part of it, I think, was, oh, okay, you know, Gordy has delivered on these Star Wars games and not, you know, made any fans too mad. So, go on this, you know.
So, what was that like then coming into going from Star Wars going to Halo? How is it different in terms of trying to be true to those fans or into that tone and atmosphere, but also knowing that it isn't, it's its own thing? I mean, Gordy, what challenges did Halo bring that, that maybe Star Wars didn't, or were they very similar in their structure?
Well, I mean, it's twofold. I mean, I guess the pleasing the fans and, you know, dealing with the high expectations and the pressure is the same. You know, I mean, musically and aesthetically, they're very different. You know, but with Halo, actually, I feel like I had maybe even a bit more freedom to sort of inject my own aesthetic musically. And, you know, the Halo music universe is well known, but it's also pretty diverse. And so I, you know, I had sort of an opportunity there to put my own musical stamp on things, you know, versus Star Wars, where, you know, if it doesn't sound like John Williams wrote it, then somebody's upset.
Right. And then Tryphon, if I have your background correct, I mean, you were into guitar in a big way, metal, and then now you're a composer working with orchestras, but also, I mean, do you let your hair down, so to speak? Like, are you bringing rock into these classic franchises, or are you trying to pave your own way and bring that background with it, or am I just totally wrong?
No. I mean, so, you know, your roots are always with you in some form or another, and you always carry that, but not necessarily in a literal way where, you know, I don't need to inject heavy metal guitars into everything. Actually, I think most of the time it's not appropriate. So, in addition to like growing up loving heavy metal and being a rock guy, I also have a long background and a career in electronic music. So it's kind of bringing all those things together. But it's always in the context of what is appropriate for the project. So Halo Wars 2, you know, as you're mentioning, it's part of the Halo franchise. There's like a certain sound that was established with past Halo games. And, you know, we all wanted to pay respect to that and incorporate some of that and then bring in new elements as well. And I think with Halo Wars 2, you know, I wanted to like bring sort of the, some of the textural elements that both Brian White and I had brought to, the anniversaries, like in the Master Chief Collection, like Halo 2 anniversary. So the texture elements, but, you know, we wanted a more sophisticated orchestral palette, and that's why we're like, okay, Gordy is the guy. And that's what really, I think, helped separate it was from past Halo projects is the level of sophistication with the orchestra. And we also went in some weirder directions with the like textural and ambient music as well.
Yeah, it is an incredible score. When I was playing the game, I streamed a little bit of it and then have played more since. And it gets you so revved up for something. White, if I could ask, like when you guys are scoring or writing this music or the ambient noise for what is an RTS video game, how do you balance that? Like, where I'm going to get your blood pumping, you're going to go kick some butt because that's what you're doing. But at the end of the day, the way you're playing the game is moving a little cursor around and clicking A and X a whole bunch. And you're not like in the trenches, you know, jackboot kicking people and shooting them in their face. It's a strategy game, but it still has that let's go get them atmosphere.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, so we talked before we even started writing cues. We worked on sort of the interactive design and how the music was going to respond to the gameplay so that, you know, it helped kind of push you through the RTS. So when you're kind of base building and things like that, you're going to hear more mellow kind of ambient cues that don't have a lot of melodic content. So you don't get too bored because you could kind of be spending a while building your base. And that's going to dynamically ramp up as you get into some skirmishes and things like that. We actually have color codes for these cues that we build for each map. And so there's really sort of four sort of base cues. You have a green, a yellow, a red, and a super red, and those correspond to the intensity of the battle that you're experiencing. And so the Wise engine, through various scripting and things like that, or, you know, kind of real time player controls that are coming back into the middleware, will essentially pick what cue you're hearing and how you're hearing it, in terms of submixing it. And so that can really kind of help you feel the right way at the right moment of battle. And so there's even kind of intelligent scripting for the super red cues where it kicks that in only sort of towards the end. And those are the most thematic, epic. Those are the ones that are really, you know, kind of make you want to take that last, you know, push into the end of the battle.
Yeah, because it's such a video games in general are more dynamic than TV or movies in the sense that there's player control. But in something like an RTS, when I can zoom all the way out or instantly jump back to my base, like I can be in a firefight, you know, going to town against a wave of enemies and then realize I need to base build and in a second pop back. And I can't, when you're composing music for it or having the cues set up, it can't be like da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Like it all needs to blend and make sense. And what I'm doing cannot make any sense, right? Like, sure, like as the player, I can be running around like a chicken with its head cut off. And your guys' job is to make that sound beautiful. I don't know how you, is it just scripting and hoping that it all blends together, or are you play testing this? What's that process?
Yeah, so a lot of it is actually, I mean, a lot of what you're describing are challenges that are dealt with in the implementation. And so the audio programmers and the audio implementers at Creative Assembly, you know, they did a lot of tuning to kind of work with these different sort of emotional intensities that we built in different submixes. To get that to kind of balance through playtesting. So, for example, if you, like you said, you're in the middle of this huge battle and then you scroll back over to your base real quick to see what's going on, you know, there's going to be rules about, you know, cooldown and things like that in terms of like, so you're not just hearing this like radio switching like instantly. So, and the cues are actually built in modular ways so that we can trigger endings and things like that. So we have exits that it can kind of end a cue, kind of tie a bow around it if you need to get down to a lower level. But yeah, it's a lot of sort of thinking about how to make things modular compositionally and how do we build the assets so that you can kind of really go hard on them in implementation. But then it is a lot of just clever work by the audio programmers and the implementers with a lot of play testing to kind of get it balanced in actual gameplay.
Yeah, that's it. Crazy. Gordy, between I'll start with you, and if Wider, Trifon, if you guys can chime in too, that'd be awesome. But when you're scoring or composing for television or film, how different is working in video games than a traditional, you know, other media? You have a master's in scoring for motion pictures, TV and other media from USC. So I know you have experience there. I know you've worked on television, TV shows that I've seen, and I'm sure many of our listeners have seen. Is it just a bigger book of music when you have to do a video game because you have to account for every scenario?
Yeah,
I mean, or what's that process like?
Quite a few things, actually. I mean, from a technical standpoint, I mean, everything that Brian Lee White was just saying, I mean, these are factors that don't exist in television or film because you're dealing with sort of a finite timeline. And with games, I mean, anything can happen, so you have to really account for basically every possible scenario. And from a creative standpoint, you really have to, you know, once you sort of have your guidelines, your parameters set, the rules that are set that Brian was talking about, I mean, then the job is to be creative within those parameters. And it's pretty tricky because you have to, you know, it's with film, for example, I mean, when you're just dealing with a strict timeline, it's like, I know I have this many seconds to write a piece of music. It leads to this emotion and that emotion needs to happen on this cut and so on. But with games, I mean, you really have to cover a lot of emotions, you know, so there's typically a lot more music in games than maybe a typical film. You know, but then also there is, you know, some similarities as well, because, you know, with Halo Wars 2, for example, there's these really beautiful cutscenes that Blur Studios created, and you know, we scored those essentially like we were scoring a film. So they were scored to picture to hit every cut, and you know, and sort of live in, you know, in that, you know, set timeline, I suppose. And from a creative standpoint, they're very much the same. I mean, really, it's just you're always dealing with human emotions. So, you know, I mean, in a game, there's the same level of, you know, variety of emotions that you might have in, you know, as an audience member watching a film or a TV show. And you really have to touch on all of those things in order to sort of heighten the end user's experience. So, I mean, they're a lot alike in many ways. You know, from the technical side of things, they're very different. But, you know, I always try to approach game scores just like I would approach a film score, you know, having themes for specific characters and making sure I'm covering every, you know, possible emotion so the audience has some kind of like thread or attachment to the end product.
Sure. Do you consider yourself a master manipulator then? You're just playing with human emotions, whether we want it to happen or not?
That's basically what we do.
Tryphon, how do you craft a story with music? So is it you're approaching either in Halo Wars 2 where you're, you know, ranging from base building I can be doing for hours or going into a combat scenario that might last also several minutes. What is that emotional story arc of those smaller moments within the larger game? Is it something where you're looking to just dictate the player's emotion of like fear or tension or peace and tranquility, or are you trying to create mini story arcs throughout where you have this piece arranged that allows multiple emotions to take place in one scenario?
Yeah, so I think it's a little bit of both, because you know, so you're obviously like when writing the music, we know about sort of like if it's not playable yet, which in the case of Halo Wars 2, like a lot of time when we were composing the music, it wasn't really anything to play. They're still developing it. But we have, you know, documents that sort of lay out the design. So we sort of know what the setting is and what the scenarios are that are going to happen. And so, you know, the way that I like to think about it is, you know, I want to create music that sets the mood and the ability for people to feel. So not to hit them over the head with like, this is exactly how you need to feel this moment, but sort of, to have different levels of tension that have like a little bit of ambiguity to the sound of it so that it just opens you up to feeling and, you know, and it has tension to it, but it's not hitting you over the head and telling you, okay, well, this is exactly how you need to feel. And that actually tends to work pretty well in games because, you know, a lot of different things can happen and it can go in either direction. So I like to kind of go a little understated on outright emotion until it's appropriate. So for the things like the cutscenes, and this is something that Gordy is fantastic at, like he mentioned, you know, writing character themes where, you know, the different characters like Isabel and Atriox, they have their own melodic themes associated with them and there's sonic textures associated with them. And so that, you know, triggers to the audience something very specific that, you know, that something's happening with those characters. But outside of that context, it's, you know, I leave a little bit of ambiguity.
Do you have a favorite instrument or texture sound piece that you kind of lean on more often than not, or is it always starting from scratch and finding the right thing for the right moment?
So, I mean, usually for any project, like we try to come up with sort of a palette of sounds at the beginning so that we can use throughout. And so usually I'll spend, you know, a couple weeks just creating sounds for a specific project, you know, and in my background, a lot of it is sort of I'll record organic sounds like guitars or just like objects and things like that, and then build sort of software like sample instruments out of them that we can use throughout. And having that palette that is custom but specific for the project, I think really helps bring just a specific character to that project. It makes it sound unique because, like, you know, there's a million composers out there and we all have the same tools. We all have the same commercial sample libraries and synths and things like that. So to sort of stand out and distinguish ourselves, like, I try to create a cool sound set for us to use just on the project.
Yeah, that's awesome. White, when players are playing the game, is there a moment or a piece of music that stands out to you that players should look for without maybe spoiling something? I don't know if you know when it will show up. It's like at the very end of the game after this happens. Is there a moment or a texture or some sound that happens in the game that you're most proud of that players should keep an ear out for?
I would say one thing to listen to, it's actually a main menu cue. What's the name? It's the first cue on the second disc.
Cratered.
And so if you listen, and this actually kind of ties all of our sounds together, there's a lead line that sort of sounds vaguely similar to a solo string instrument, but then that's a sound that we designed that plays the main melody. And then an actual cello that we recorded during our sessions at Fox kind of doubles that melody. And so it's just kind of this really cool, organic kind of there's something that's kind of otherworldly and synthetic about it. But then there's also this real organic kind of component to it. And I thought that turned out really, really well, just sort of how we blended our two sounds, the finishing move and sort of Gordy's work with the orchestra.
Yeah, that's awesome. I love stuff like that because I feel like when done well, the layman doesn't notice anything. We're just like, that was pleasant or that was cool. And then the people that have experience are like, oh, no. Wow, that's so much is happening here. And I'm just like, of course, that's what it sounds like as you go through the world or you know, open up the menus and interact with the game.
There's also these other sounds, and Gordy can elaborate on what he did with this orchestrally. So we had designed these kind of really raspy, kind of like synthetic, you know, kind of like brass hits. If you're into electronic music, they're called Reese's. They're kind of this bass nasty, kind of nasty bass sound that kind of evolves with filters and kind of distortion. And so we use those a lot in our production because it kind of just gives this really visceral kind of intense hit to moments. And Gordy heard those, and he actually came up kind of with a way to orchestrate a organic version of that using the brass in the orchestra to kind of mimic the filtering. Do you guys know what the name of a cue that does that? Because we did it on a few, Gordy.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of what the titles were on the soundtrack, but I did that on quite a few of them actually, and it is a pretty cool effect. I think Baron, is one of the tracks on the soundtrack. I think it's track two.
Yeah,
Baron. And what I essentially did is I heard this sound that finishing move had come up with, and I thought it just struck me as really cool and gritty, and the way it evolved, and it was, you know, the way the filters sort of manipulated, you know, the sound, the timbre, and I thought, how cool would it be to sort of double that with an organic live version of the same effect? And so what I did is I, you know, used the brass section and various mutes within the brass instruments to create the sound of a filter. So maybe I'd start with like the low trombones and they would have no mutes in, and then the sound would pass on to the upper trombones and they'd have a different type of mute in the horn, and then pass it to the French horns open and the French horns with a mute. And so it actually created, like, as it crossfaded from one section of the brass section to the other, sort of this sound of like a filter sweep over a brass pad, which is, I think it was a pretty cool effect. I'm pretty happy with it, and the way it works with the synthetic version kind of creates this, you know, this otherworldly kind of sound that my knowledge hasn't really been
big up. Sound too. It's like a pretty visceral,
yeah,
sound. So it's really cool.
Yeah, that sounds awesome. So Gordy, having what I will say for you, conquered Halo and conquered Star Wars, conquered The Walking Dead, among others, what's next? Are you going to continue? I mean, Harry Potter, James Bond, Star Trek, or are you looking to to do the, put your stamp on something entirely new that so 10 years from now when whoever's doing this podcast will be talking, being like, okay, so you've taken on Gordy's work. And not to say that you haven't done great original work, but stepping into this fandom world, do you have a hit list of things that you want to go and kind of play in that world? Or are you looking to kind of do more creating an entirely new sound for something?
I mean, I'm always interested in, and even within these existing sounds, I always do this, but I'm always most interested in trying to have my own sort of aesthetic and my own voice, so to speak. And so with all of these franchises, yes, I have existing music, and you know, I have to sort of study that and make sure that I'm living within that sound to some extent, but I always try to, you know, put a stamp on it that's you know, definitively my own. And so I'm pretty good at finding ways to do that and still make it live within, you know, that existing sound. And I think a big part of it is, you know, making a choice to either directly imitate or to actually just absorb and internalize what makes that sound what it is, and then just do your own thing and just sort of let it, you know, breathe through that existing color palette, so to speak. And but you know, I would love to do a project that was, you know, completely, you know, from the ground up, you know, write my own brand new music, my whole new take on it. And if I was going to do another existing franchise, I'm a huge Star Trek fan as well as Star Wars. And I think it'd be really cool to sort of dive into that world on some level as well.
Yeah, cool. And Brian's, so you guys are Finishing Movies, your company, right? Your baby. Yeah. If there's a thing outside of the game world, you guys have done such great work in the video game world, and you've done work outside of the video game space too, but if there was something outside of the video game space that you would love to tackle and take on, what would that be?
I think like a television show would be really cool, like just, you know, something that's moody and vibey that we could really just add our sound to, I think would be cool. Brian White, what do you think?
Yeah, definitely. I think TV right now is kind of the golden era of TV, and there's just like some really cool scores getting made for television. That you just, if you go back 10 years ago, it just wasn't the case. But now, you know, with Netflix and Amazon and all the cable networks and HBO, it's just like the bar on TV scores has gotten so high and so cool and so different, right? So you're starting to hear stuff like, whether it's Mr. Robot or that show Billions, and it's like really kind of out of the box, non-traditional composers working with electronics and things like that, and creating really, really cool narrative soundscapes and kind of really thinking outside the box. So yeah, definitely TV would be something we'd love to get into.
Very cool. Well, you guys certainly crushed it with Halo Wars 2 and my layman's very experienced video game playing and analyzing and listening to, but no experience actual creating in that world. One thing I like to kind of run down as we wind down, I don't want to keep you guys forever. Well, I want to, but I respect your time as professionals, so I won't. And we can start Gordy with you, and then everybody can kind of give their two cents. What would you tell someone looking to have your job when they grow up? A place to start, not do it, do it, do it, do it. What's that recommendation?
I would say only do it if your heart is 100% in it, because it requires a lot of sacrifice and a lot of time. And, you know, and there's, you know, the industry has its ups and downs, and you're going to get rejected and you're going to have to deal with that. But if it's what you really love and you really truly 100% want to do this thing, then absolutely you should go for it. And the best way to get into it is to meet people. I mean, it seems kind of simple, but just meet people making games or meet people making films. And, you know, a good way to do that is to go to the conferences, go to the Game Developers Conference. It happens every year in San Francisco. You know, that's go to move to Los Angeles or move to a city where that industry sort of thrives. You know, I mean, that's a big risk for a lot of people, but it's one you have to take. And, you know, that's a risk I took, you know, maybe 15 years ago, moving out to LA to get into film. And I just started meeting student filmmakers and, one thing led to the next, and a friend of mine that I'd worked with many times was now an audio lead at LucasArts, and said, "Hey, we have this Indiana Jones video game, and you know, we'd love for you to, you know, submit a demo for it." And I had just written this music for sort of the Star Wars fan film called Ryan versus Dorkman, and the guy that made that film was just a guy I met, you know, at a Starbucks or something like that, and noticed he was working on a script and started talking. And the music I'd written for that, I used for my demo.
Has that story come out before, that that's how you guys met?
I don't know, actually.
That's crazy. One, it's awesome. Two, that's crazy.
Yeah, so that's just how it works, man. I mean, you have to be where it's happening, you know, and that is a big risk for many people. I mean, but look, if your heart's 100% in it, then you got to take that risk. And, you know, I did. And like I say, one thing led to the next, and that one person gave me an opportunity. That opportunity led to the first video game that I had done, the Indiana Jones video game, which sort of sealed the deal that I was sort of LucasArts guy for a long time, doing all of their Star Wars games, which led to Battlefront, and then ultimately led to Halo Wars 2, because, you know, I probably wouldn't have had that opportunity had I not already proven that I could live and write within an existing franchise with a large fan base. So, you know, it all starts from very small, humble beginnings, but you have to take that first risk.
So all I heard is get your coffee from Starbucks. Cool.
Yeah.
That's incredible. And then Brian's same question, but then also the next step on top of it would be, you know, creating finishing move and going out and, you know, that's never an easy thing to do, to say, here's our shingle, we're hanging it up. Sorry, debt, here I come.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think, you know, so basically how Brian and White and I sort of teamed up was that we'd both been working freelance for a long time, like just doing our own gigs, and then we'd hire each other for stuff, and we were good friends. But, you know, what happened is sometimes not every individual person has like all of the pieces. You know, it's like you might be good at some things, but not good at everything. But, you know, we realized that we actually had very complementary skills, and that together we could take on much bigger projects. And that's kind of what we wanted to do, because, you know, I think we're both ambitious people, and we both wanted to be doing cooler projects. And part of that meant, you know, turning down some of the work that we were doing before and teaming up and aiming for bigger things. And that meant taking a risk. And so that's sort of what we did, is, you know, took a risk and stuck our necks out there, and we're like, okay, we can do this. And we ended up, you know, landing some great projects. But as Gordy was saying, it's like you have to have very thick skin and be 100% in it, because there's a lot of stuff that falls through and doesn't work out. There's a lot of rejection. There's a lot of, there's a lot of frustration that goes along with it. And it's a slow process too. So, And the things that, you know, like, if speaking to people that are starting their careers, they don't realize is like, so for all this stuff that they get to see and hear about, like, oh, cool, we did Halo Wars 2 and Master Chief Collection and other stuff. Like, there's a lot of things before that that nobody's heard about or that fell through. So, yeah, you really have to persevere and take some risks too.
Yeah, I was at Comic-Con, this was years ago now, and there was an office panel, and one of the people asked Rainn Wilson afterward, and the question, it was sincere and whatever, I empathize for the question asker, but they just asked Rainn Wilson, they said, what office did they find you working in when you got this part? And he was like, excuse me? Like, well, clearly you work in an office. And he's like, no, clearly I'm classically trained. I was on Shakespeare. And like, it's like, that's not how it happens. And
right.
Like, he had this moment of just like, oh my God. And people just don't realize that there's, you know, infinite time before your quote unquote, whether it's your out of nowhere break, like picked out of a crowd of millions. It's
right.
Well, sure, but imagine that talent didn't to show up randomly, all the hard work that went into creating that.
Yeah, no, for sure.
Yeah, I've written music for about 50 films you've never heard of, I promise you.
Yeah, Brian White, what about you? Do you have a tip or trick for someone that wants to get into, that wants to take your job when you're old and retired?
Yeah, I would say that working, if you're going to, whether you're making music for albums or making music for television or making music for video games, 99% of the time you're going to be working as part of a team. Sometimes that team is going to be really, really big. And sometimes your team members are not always going to agree with you or be coming from the same point as you in terms of what they think might be best for the project. So in other words, there's a lot of stakeholders, especially when you get into high budget film and AAA video games. And so just sort of learning how to, in addition to being great at composing and making music, learning how to be a cool person that is flexible and can sort of sympathize and empathize with where others are coming from, and just kind of not being a weird dude, not being an ass, and not kind of, you know, keeping your ego in check within the team, and kind of just being a good friend, a cool person to hang out with. You know, the secret, I think, is people want to work with their friends. They want to work with people they like. And you might be surprised, but sometimes they'll pick their bro or their friend over someone who is maybe more qualified for the job, but they don't, I don't like that guy because I'm going to spend long hours and we're going to really want to come together and have a decent time doing this. Cause you know, when it comes down to the crunch, it can get miserable. And so you really want to have people on your team that you like to be around. And sometimes I run into younger people and they ask, you know, like, oh, I'm having a hard time getting gigs. And it's like, well, are you focusing on not being kind of a weirdo? I mean, we're all weirdos, but in the sense of like, you know, are you cool? Are you friendly? Are you good to hang out with? Or do you get along well with others? And I think that's like half of it, or more than half. Like, you know, the other half of just being a good composer, it's just kind of like being a person that other people want to work with, and they think about when they think about, hey, who do I want to be in the trenches with? Who do I want to have my back in this situation? And they don't really teach you that in any of the schools. They don't. I feel like they don't teach any of those skills, and it's kind of a shame. You kind of have to just like learn it on your own. But that would be my tip.
That's a great point, and also a really smooth humble brag for saying that you're just the dopest dude to hang out with.
Kind of a story about how the team for this came together. We were on the Halo Wars 2 team because we had done work in the Halo franchise before. So we were kind of brought on to the team, and the audio director, Paul Lipson, who's a good friend of ours, and we've worked with him for a long time on Halo stuff. He was kind of like, well, who do you guys want to bring on, you know, to do this, to do the orchestral, the heavy lifting of the orchestral stuff. And he kind of threw out, he's like, you know, I got this guy, Gordy Hab. And, at that moment, I had never met him. Neither of us had met him. And he said, hey, let's just like set up a meet and vibe. And instantly we knew Gordy was a super cool dude. And actually, like, there's a lot of composers that are not the coolest dudes to hang out with. But Gordy was just like, we were just like instant friends and have been ever since. And so I feel like this specific, you know, game project is a testament to that kind of like, you know, people that, you know, are buds and work well together and just really come together at crunch time.
It's totally true. I mean,
totally true that you're a cool dude. Is that what you're?
Yeah. No, he's right that, I mean, you really just have to vibe with the people you're working with. Cause I mean, you're really in the trenches for long periods of time. And I mean, you know, to be in the trenches with somebody you don't even get along with, I mean, that's just misery. So
yeah.
I mean,
and there's like a lot of people that it's like, I mean, there's people out there that are amazingly talented, but that are just like really, really unpleasant. And it's just that's not worth it at all. You know?
No, that is too true. You spend more time with your colleagues than you do your family. So keep in mind that you get to, when you can, pick your colleagues. pick them well. The last thing I always want to do is where people can keep up with you and see more of your work and keep in touch and stuff like that if they'd like. But before we get there, the second to last thing that I would like to do, you guys don't have to answer this, but I always enjoy asking the question. What advice would you give yourself 10 years in the future? So the thing 10 years from now, the thing that you want yourself to remember right now, whether it's, you know, it can be anything. Hey, life's beautiful. You saw a butterfly today, or hang in there, kitty cat, or quit. What are you doing? Whatever that note, this little time capsule, this audio time capsule we're creating, Gordy, what does 10-year future you need to hear?
Don't quit. Because, I mean, there's many times, you know, over the past 15 years of, you know, venturing out to LA and trying to make a career in composing music where I wanted to just quit, give up. It would be easier to move back where I grew up and be around my friends from, you know, high school and college, and here out here all by myself and don't know anyone and I have to meet new people, and it's overwhelming. And so, you know, but now looking back on it, you know, I really stuck it out and I put in the hard work and it's all paying off, and, you know, very happy with where I am in my career. So if I was to tell myself 10 years ago, I'd just say, hey, look, man, you know, hang on. It'll be okay. You know, just keep putting in the work.
Don't but what do you tell 2029 you? What's the future you need to hear?
Yeah, that's a good question, man. That's actually a philosophical question. Hopefully, good job.
Hopefully the Oscar goes to, or
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That's awesome. Brian Trifon, do you have advice for 10 years ago you and 10 years future you? What is that thing that you need to hear or that you think you need to hear if Bill and Ted, that telephone booth lands in your yard and you have 10 seconds?
Yeah. Well, if it's the future me, then I would want to travel back in time and somehow change the outcome of the election that happened last year. So that would be where the future me would be like, okay, you need to travel back to November 2016 and influence the outcome of the election so that it just changes the world back to the timeline it's supposed to be on.
Well, that was actually Ashton Kutcher's fault when he made the movie Butterfly Effect. He actually altered the timeline by making that. So neither here nor there.
There we go. So I'd have to like go back and have him not make that film, I think. That's, in terms of what I'd tell myself in the past, like 10 years ago, I think it's just to persevere, you know, and I think that's sort of a common theme throughout all of us. But yeah, it's just like perseverance is the main ingredient, I think.
And Brian Wright, yours wouldn't be bet on the Cubs or the Cavaliers that pays out huge.
No, I mean, I don't know. I feel like mine would be like keep your drinking in check, Brian, or something to that extent. I would say, you know, one thing that I think we all get kind of wrapped up in, especially as we get, as work consumes us and our profile sort of climbs, is just, you know, like, just remind yourself to spend time with your family and remember what's really important, because I think sometimes we can kind of get away from that. And my grandpa died recently and I was able to see him right before he died, and it just kind of reminded me of like mortality and what really matters. So that's probably what I would tell my future 10-year, like, are you doing good by your family?
Yeah. Way to bring it down. Well, this was awesome. If you haven't, go pick up and play Halo Wars 2. It's available on the Xbox One and PC, part of the Play Anywhere games that Microsoft has out right now. Gordy, if people want to see more of your work or keep in touch with you or try to meet you as their person that they move out to LA and meet and try to prove that they're a cool hang, where can people see more of your work or keep in touch?
Keep in touch with me. You can look me up on Facebook or Twitter, and it's at Gordy Hab. It's my Twitter. And I have a website that I wouldn't recommend people go to because it hasn't been updated in about 4 years. But I'm going to take care of that, and you can hopefully hear some of my work there. Just check out the games I've worked on. Battlefront's most recent, in addition to Halo Wars 2. That's it.
Cool. Awesome. Brian White, what about you?
You can check out our website, fidgetymoveinc.com. We're also on Facebook, both of us individually and our company. I'm at Brian Lee White on Twitter. Yeah, we got a SoundCloud, so Finishing Move, just search that on SoundCloud, and you can check out what we're up to sonically.
Yep, and then all the things that Brian White said, and then my Twitter handle is at Trifonic. I'm also just on Facebook, so yeah, look me up and add me, and maybe I'll answer your friend request.
Yeah, that's brave. Facebook is the that's brave. Well, guys, thank you so much for taking the time. I really, really appreciate it. Yeah, this was awesome. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Christian.
Thank you.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.